Good afternoon and welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, December 23rd, 2020. Happy holidays to everybody. First order of business is to approve the agenda. Is there a motion to approve?
So move.
Second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? If not, all in favor say aye, please.
Aye.
All right. Thank you. The agenda has been approved and we will go to the education topic. However, before that, I will say that this is being held still under the COVID-19 notice. And so therefore there is no public comment period. Although we do ask that any public who would like to make a comment has the ability to do that, go online and jeffersonhealthcare.com.org, .org, and you will see how to get in touch with us, and we welcome your comments. We will address them at the next meeting. So this is being recorded, and we will now move on to the education topic, which is Home Health and Hospice Annual Update with Tammy Tarsa, our Executive Director of Home Health and Hospice.
Tammy? All right. Thank you for having me today. I appreciate your time. And I did just want to, I actually have 45 minutes. I was going to say spend a few minutes, but I guess I have more than a few, don't I? But spend this time with you sharing home health, hospice, and palliative care. The push to do this right now is, and we're going to talk about this as we go through the presentation, but we are attempting to go through hospice accreditation. And one of the requirements is that we have a governing body. And in conversations with Tina, she, with her peers, determined that you, as the commissioners, would be our governing body. And there are very specific requirements to that. One of those is education. So we're going to utilize this period of time to provide education on home health, hospice, focusing on hospice, because that's where we are right now, and palliative care as well. So that's the plan. I'm pretty informal. I did take off my reindeer ears in a bid for professionalism, but pretty informal person. So if you have questions, please just shout them out. If you're anything like me, if you wait, you might forget. So I'm good with that. And I will do my very best to answer them. If I don't have an answer, I will write it down and get back with you. So, oops, I don't have control. Okay, next, please. So this is the agenda as we move forward, where we are going to look at the hospice standards that pertain specifically to the governing body. And I'll give just a brief explanation about those. We'll review the organizational chart, of which you guys play a part, the hospice philosophy and care, and then the services that we provide. It's going to be really important that as the governing body, you understand what we do here at hospice, an overview of the program. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you back as a look back through 2020, let you know where some of our challenges were, let you know where some of our successes were, and then let you know where we're headed in 2021. All right, next, please. Just as before we move on, I just wanted to share some background. We had hoped to go through accreditation this year, and we were actually had started to work on our policies this spring, January, February, and then COVID hit, and you know, life as we know it all but stopped. And so we decided that we had enough on our plate handling the COVID pandemic, that we were not going to move forward with the accreditation at that time. However, once we got through that initial kind of hump, we discovered that it was not quite autopilot, but you know, you get used to it. And so we had time to go back to accreditation. And so we started looking at accreditation again this fall, and decided that we were gonna push forward and hopefully get through accreditation. Our goal is to be done by the end of Q2. So we'll see if that works. We're already a little behind in our schedule, and I'll explain that as we go, but wanted to let you know that. So we have chosen to work with ACHC. They are the Accreditation Commission for Healthcare. They are a sister partner to DNV, which is who our hospital is accredited through. I have actually, in a past life, worked with ACHC before, and so I know the type of organization that they are, and that also helped when I started to, when we started to determine which organization we would work through. ACHC is very focused on education, and while they will certainly give you a deficiency if you are in need of one, I found that they're very supportive. They want to be that collaborative partner. They want to help you be successful. They're not as excited about those gotchas as maybe some other organizations might appear to be. So really liked their approach, and so they have been very helpful thus far as well. So when we're looking at accreditation for hospice, there are seven sections of standards. There is one section on organization and administration. There's a section on program services and operations. Section three is fiscal management. Four is human resource management. Section five is patient record management. Section six is quality outcomes, performance improvement. And then risk management, infection and safety control is section seven. And each of those have multiple policies in them. Some are COPs, so they're policies that are regulated by Medicare. Some of those are not. Some of those are ACHC standards that they say are best practice. There is an eighth section as well, and that is a distinction for palliative care. We're going to talk about palliative care just briefly a little bit later, but we are moving forward with a palliative care program. One of the requirements for that distinction is that you have to be, you have to have a hospice or a home health accreditation in order to receive that distinction. So when we start to develop the palliative care program, we are going to look at those policies and standards in Section 8 and really build our program off of those so that we are prepared when the time comes to reach out for that distinction. So as far as the timeline goes, our goal was to have reviewed all of our policies by the end of December. And while we have done that, we are going back through them again and creating a great big task list of everything that we have to do. So the first time we went through our policies, we compared our policies against the Medicare standards. We compared them against the state of Washington, RCA, WACs, and then we looked at the standards through ACHC. So we took all of those and we looked at what we were currently doing because sometimes we were on target and sometimes we weren't. So we looked at all of those pieces, revamped our policies, and then we're going through them again now and making that great big to-do list. We hope to send our completed policies out to ACHC for a review by the beginning of February. So that's our time frame. Between now and when we call for our survey, which we hope is going to be sometime in May, we're working on education. We're working on changing any practices that need to be done. We're having education time with you. I met with the providers in November as well. So we'll call for our survey, hopefully in May, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe not. And then our survey can happen anytime 60 days after that. We can block out 10 days. And so looking at vacations, we'll have to determine when the best time to call for that survey is. But that's kind of our game plan right now. So that's where we are. Any questions on any of that?
Nope.
Okay, very good. Thanks. Next slide, please. So there are two policies, two standards that speak specifically to the governing board, and this is the first one. So the hospice is directed by a governing body which assumes full legal authority and responsibility for the operations of the hospice. The hospice must organize, manage, and administer its resources to provide the hospice care and services to patients, caregivers, and families necessary for the palliation and management of the terminal illness and related conditions. The governing body duties and accountabilities are clearly defined. So one of the pieces of literature that we have purchased in order to help us prepare for accreditation is a guidelines book, and it not only provides the standards, but then it gives us these hints, which help us to better understand exactly what the surveyor is going to be looking for when they come to do our survey. And so on this standard, the hint that is included states, if interviewed, the administrator and governing body should be able to discuss how the governing body exercises their responsibilities for the overall operations of the organization, The surveyor will expect to see evidence of the oversight of the hospice by the governing body. So it's my hope that I can come annually and talk with you. And then the plan is that as we have updates or changes, I would somehow do that quarterly, maybe just provide a written report for your packet agenda so that I'm not taking up too much of your time and you can read it. But then it's included and we can say that it was done. And then the surveyors, they may want to speak to one or more individuals from the governing body. So those are items that they, those were the hints they provided. Next slide, please. So these are the specific areas that the governing body is responsible for: decision-making, appointing a qualified administrator, arranging for professional advice, establishing or approving written policies and procedures governing operations. And so once our policies are complete and once they have been approved by ACHC, I will send out a notice to you. I did ask Brandy if you had access to policy stat in our system, and she said you did, which is where all of our policies are. So we'll make sure that you know how to get in into that, and then you can have access to review those policies. I always tell my staff that the important thing is not always what you know, but you know where to find it if you don't know. So there you go. If the surveyor should ask, you know, we'll know where to go for the policies. Human resource management, and we're going to spend some time talking about that. Quality assessment, performance improvement, our QAPI area. Community needs planning, and I do have a big, hairy, audacious goal that I will mention at the very end, save the very best for last. Oversight of the management and fiscal affairs of the hospice and the annual review of hospice, of the annual review of the policies and procedures. And then, as I said, many of these items will be discussed later on in the presentation. Next slide, please. So this is the second standard. And just in case you all wanted to know, let's see, if I were to go back to the first standard, it says HSP 1-2B. That is a Medicare standard. And the way you can tell the difference, I want to point, is that the 0.03 on this one means that it's an ACH standard. So anything that has a 0.03 or a 0.04 or any points means it's an ACHC standard. If it's just a straight 1-2B, 1-2G, that's a Medicare standard, in case you were curious. All right. So this is an ACHC standard. Governing body members receive an orientation to the responsibilities and accountability. So welcome to your orientation. An orientation includes, but is not limited to organizational structure, confidentiality practices, hospice philosophy and care, overview of programs, personnel and patient grievances, policies and procedures, responsibilities of the QAPI, organizational ethics, and conflict of interest. Whoops, hold on just a second. I have to get to my notes. And so the hint that they provided for us on this standard is the hospice must produce written evidence of an orientation for governing body members that includes at least the minimal requirements, which are those that we just listed. And so that is what we're going to focus on today. And we're going to use these minutes because that's what they've said we could use as the written evidence. So the surveyor will expect to see the list of the governing body members on site that includes name, address, and telephone numbers. I don't know why they want us to have those things, but we will be asking for those things so that we meet that requirement. And the survey will expect to see a signed conflict of interest disclosure statement. And, you know, we're pretty fortunate in this sense because the hospital is also accredited, and many of these standards are very similar. And so by being a part of the hospital commissioners, you've taken care of many of these items already. Next slide, please. And so I've just crossed out the areas that we are not going to focus on. And so we are going to focus on the areas in yellow today because the other ones I'm pretty confident the hospital has already covered. So we're going to look at the organizational structure, and I'll provide some background on that. Hospice philosophy, overview of programs, and responsibilities of the QAPI. All right. And next slide, please. So this is our Who would think that my daughter would call me in the middle of the afternoon? Okay, I turned it off. Sorry. So this is our organizational structure, and we have left off names just because it's easier, but I can tell you who each of these individuals are, and maybe I'll do that as we walk through. So you'll see that Tina is at the very top. She is my boss, and then it comes down to me. We have you as the Jefferson Healthcare Commissioners as our governing body, and then Dr. Mattern as our medical director on the side, because even though we don't direct report up to you, there is oversight provided by you, and so we needed to make sure that that was recognized in our organizational structure. From there, you see it comes down. We have a hospice clinical manager who is Rachel Hugg. Reporting up to her are all of the clinicians that work through hospice, as well as a few odds and ends nurses. So our evening and afternoon nurses and our per diem nurses, just because our home health has a greater number of staff, and I had to try to balance those two. Our office specialist is Crystal. We have a handful of office staff. They're operational, so they report up to me. Our QAPI manager is Deb Caldall, and she is leading the fight in accreditation. And then our home health clinical manager position is currently open. If you know anyone who's looking for a job in healthcare, please pass them my way, because as you'll see, I have a lot of positions open. And all of the home health staff report up to that position. It has not always been like this. This is a recent change. Back in the spring, I made the decision to programmatically divide the manager position. So prior to that occurring, the managers had different responsibilities, but they worked in both home health and hospice. And it was really confusing. I found it to be very confusing. The clinical staff didn't know who to go to for what area, and there was no specificity, right? The clinical managers were so busy understanding all of the aspects of home health and hospice that they couldn't really focus on one or two aspects, the important things. So I made the decision to divide them programmatically. At that time, I did not divide the staff as I have it written here. However, our home health manager has resigned, and it provided me the opportunity to then divide the staff programmatically as well. So that is a recent change, and if you asked my staff, they probably wouldn't know that yet, because that manager position is still open, and so things are kind of as they were, kind of, sort of. So, but that is the plan as soon as that position is filled. As far as the hospice volunteers, you'll see that they also report down to me right now. So our hospice volunteer coordinator resigned in October of 2019. And when she resigned, I made the decision to not fill that position and to put that that work under the hospice manager, in part because I wanted to utilize those FTEs in a different way. You know, you're limited as to the number of FTEs you can have, and I felt I had a better plan for them. So I made that move. It did not go well for a variety of reasons. It just didn't work well. So I brought those hospice volunteers back under me, and we're going to talk a little bit more about volunteers, and that is working. So hospice volunteers are back, and I've gotten a really good, I feel I've gotten a really good handle on them, and we're forging ahead with good relationships. And the plan is for the future to put them back under the hospice clinical manager, but I needed to give Rachel, she's new, she started in October, I needed to give her time to get her feet wet. I needed to get a handle on the situation with the hospice volunteers. And Rachel's so focused on accreditation, I want to get through that point, and then I will probably pass them back off because I know she'll do an incredible job with them. So that's kind of where we are with the volunteers and with our organization. Any questions?
No.
You guys are an easy group. Wow. All right.
We're working on it, Tony.
Actually, if you don't mind, I do have a question.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
This is Case, by the way.
Hi.
So I'm wondering, you said that there are a lot of positions open.
Yes.
Is this a national problem, getting enough staff for this kind of thing? Or is this a regional, or is this a local issue that involves things like difficulty with housing, childcare, whatever?
It's all of the above. Yes. So it starts at the national level. There is a shortage for nurses. And if you look at the literature that's out, the nursing shortage is just supposed to steadily increase. That is a problem that we in Jefferson Healthcare can't fix. It's a national shortage. Regionally, unfortunately, I don't know if I can speak to regionally because I'm not from the area. I will tell you that the organization that I came from, I know that region in Michigan, and they were always looking for staff. And then we are challenged by our location and housing and the cost of living and all of those things. So I will talk in-depthly about our staffing in another slide. So. Next slide, please. All right, you guys. So here is I was originally thinking we were going to be in person. And so, interacting is so much easier when you're face to face. But since we're not, we will bounce. We're going to talk about the hospice philosophy. And I'm wondering if you could just share what you know about hospice. So when you think of hospice, what do you think about?
Well, I've been involved with hospice as a caregiver for two members, my former husband, my late husband, and my mother. And I can tell you that I'm honored to be part of helping it be the best that it can be, because it's a wonderful organization. And I know people think of it as related to death, but I think of it as related to living your life to the very fullest, to the last possible moment.
Amen. Yes, thank you. Anyone else?
And I believe it's patients are, when they're evaluated, are looked upon as being in the last 6 months of their life.
Is correct. That? Yeah. Yeah. So, I spent a number of years in labor and delivery, so maternity, right? And one of the reasons I loved working with the newborns was because so often it's a celebration. It's not the sadness that we sometimes see in healthcare. It's usually, most of the time, a happy experience. And what I've learned is that there is celebration and beauty in death. You just have to know where to look and how to find it. And that is one of the things that I hope that in this position I can express to the community, that it can be so much more than what we think it is. So that's what we're working on with our staff. So as we look at the hospice philosophy, keep in mind that's kind of the avenue that I come from. Okay, next slide, please. So what is hospice? Hospice is a team-oriented model. So when we think about hospice care, we don't think of one nurse caring for one patient. We think of a handful of clinicians with different disciplines, nurses, social work, aides, spiritual care, bereavement, even so far as physical therapy, occupational therapy. So it's a group of people, different talents, not only helping the patient, but helping the patient and the family and caregiver. So it's a different type of model. It's different than other types of healthcare. It is there to help people who are facing a life-limiting illness. And traditionally, the Medicare language says 6 months or less. Care is palliative and not curative. I'll talk more about that in a minute. It is centered around the belief that each of us has the right to die pain-free and with dignity. Different from other types of care, hospice also uses this team model approach to support families. The hospice team understands that the patient, family, and caregiver walk this journey together. In such, our care encompasses all of these individuals. Hospice care is provided where the patient lives. So I wanted to touch base on just a couple items, because there's work for us to do. There's work for us to do. We're taking really big strides, but there's still work. So hospice is not curative. And I will be the first one to stand up and say that I think that the way our hospice rules are written need to be changed. But I'm one person, And I don't have the ability to make those changes on my own, unfortunately. I do think that in time that will happen. There is work being done at the national level to try to adjust that terminal illness language to be more palliative in approach, but that has not happened yet. So in the meantime, we're stuck with the language that we have, and hospice is not curative, which means that people are no longer seeking aggressive treatment. They do not want to go to the hospital. They don't want to call EMS. They want to remain in their home. What they need help with is managing the symptoms and finding comfort in their last days. And we are challenged. We are challenged by this. And so there's a lot of education that needs to be done with our community and with our providers to understand that we cannot admit to hospice if you're still seeking radiation therapies. And it's hard because so many of those people need hospice services. They need that wraparound service that we provide, but it's a challenge. All right, next slide, please. Who makes up the hospice team? So we have the hospice medical director, we have the patient's attending physician. So one of the things that's important to note is that patients, Medicare, it states they require, and it's actually in our consent that the patient signs, that they get to choose who they want their attending physician to be. So who do they want to follow them in their care? They get to choose. Now, they get to choose. A provider can opt out. Most people don't, but they can, but the patient gets to choose. So not only do we have the hospice medical director, we have the patient's chosen attending physician. We have nurses, hospice aides, the social worker, spiritual care, bereavement. We have volunteers, comfort therapists, and I forgot to mention them earlier. They provide music therapy, massage therapy, Reiki, those types of services, and then physical, occupational, speech therapists as needed. It's important to note that Medicare has determined that nurses, social work, spiritual care bereavement, and the physicians are core services. And what that means for us is that those services cannot be contracted. There is an exception, I'll tell you that in a minute. But those positions must be employees of our hospice organization. The exception to that are the physicians. They can be contracted, but nurses, spiritual care bereavement, social work, all have to be employed by our agency. Next slide, please. So what services do we provide? We manage the patient's pain and symptoms. We assist patients with the emotional and psychosocial, spiritual aspects of dying. We provide needed medications, medical supplies, and equipment. It's important to note that hospice provides all DME medication supplies related to a patient's terminal diagnosis and prognosis. We provide education and support. We deliver support services through volunteers and comfort therapies. We make available short-term inpatient care and respite services, because sometimes what the family or caregiver needs is just a break from providing care. And we help to support them in that, because what we know is if they're not at their best, they can't be their best for their loved one. And provides bereavement care and counseling to surviving family members. And I'm sure you all know this, but just in case, bereavement care is not reimbursed by Medicare, but it is required that we provide it for a full year after the patient passes. So that is a service that we eat. Next slide, please. Okay. So who is eligible for hospice? Individuals have a life-limiting illness with a prognosis of 6 months or less. And what they say is, I mean, we have patients that have been on our services much longer than 6 months, but what we look at is if the disease ran its normal process, would this patient pass within 6 months? Would it be expected? If the answer is yes, then they would qualify for hospice. And research actually shows that individuals live longer with hospice. So when I'm talking to staff and talking to them about admitting patients, I always ask them, if you can look at a patient and you think, I wouldn't be surprised if they weren't with us in 6 months, then they're probably eligible. So, next slide, please. who pays for hospice and Medicare, Medicaid, insurance, self-pay, and then it's important to note, too, charity care. So we do refer patients to the hospital for their financial services charity care. This is part of my BHAG at the end, and I'll talk more about where those percentages lie for us in a future slide. I'm going to start talking faster because I'm running out of time, you guys. Next slide, please. So overview of programs and initiatives. Let's see if I wanted to say anything here. Oh, no, we'll just keep moving. Next slide, please. Okay, so here we go, you guys. This is the big stuff. So what did we do this year in the world of 2020 COVID? We survived. We made it. So we were very much focused on staffing our COVID patients. We saw a lot of COVID patients, and we are still seeing COVID positive patients. And one of the challenges for us is, so when you're seeing a patient and you have to dress in full PPE, you have to be fully donned before you go into a patient's home. And so many patients, we are putting on our full gear out in the elements, right? We're standing on their porch in the rain, in the snow, in the wind, and we're trying to get all our gear on. We're finding a rock that we can put our bag in on, so the bag doesn't blow away. So when we come back out and we have to take it off in all those elements, we can put our dirty gear back in that bag. So it was a little bit of a challenge. And I will tell you that there was a lot of anxiety and trepidation associated with this process. And until we actually started to see these patients and work through the process and realize that, okay, it is not perfect, but we can do this. We were able to laugh. You know, we were able to laugh at going to a hotel, putting on our gear, coming back out and finding that the maid had thrown our stuff away and having to find it. So, you know, you can find the humor in almost anything. And so that's what we learned to do. And our staff is doing an amazing job taking care of these patients and staying safe. And I'm going to knock on wood. We haven't had any exposures through our staff. So that's great. All right. We hired a hospice manager, and this is an interesting one here because we've actually hired two hospice managers. We hired one and she left, and we've hired another one. And Rachel Hugg is our current hospice manager, and she is absolutely amazing. She's amazing. She was working as a nurse in our hospice, in the field with our hospice staff, and she moved up into that manager position, and I'm thrilled. She's great. So I feel very, very fortunate. We introduced e-kits. So e-kits are emergency kits. They contain three medications to provide immediate symptom management to patients. We do not give these to all of our patients. We primarily give these to patients who are admitting on a weekend, who it's going to take some time for the real medications to get there, and patients who, when we go out to their home, they're having immediate symptom needs, and we need to manage those right away. But those are now available to us, and that has been a great collaboration with the pharmacy, and they've been just wonderful in helping us get that done. So we reviewed the policies for accreditation. We've developed a patient caregiver guide, and I sent, here it is here, sent it out in a link so you can read through what's in there, but it really provides an in-depth look at all of the areas that patients and families might experience as they're going through this journey. It's a great book. We worked with, we bought the rights to use it with another organization that I'm aware of, and so they completely tweaked it for our organization. So it talks about Hospice of Jefferson County and what to do and call us. So it's really great. They're currently at the printers and we should have them the first of the year. So super excited about that. We've decreased our AR days, which was a huge feat. And I'll talk about that briefly in a moment. We've purchased PCA pumps, and they're in the process of being purchased, actually. We had a donation given to us for this reason. It will be a huge boon for our patients and community because we would be able to provide pain relief through infusions in patients' homes rather than having to send them to the hospital to receive that. So it'll be good for us, it'll be good for the patients, it'll be good for the hospital. So it's a win-win-win. And again, Lanny and the pharmacy, that collaboration has just been amazing. They're really great over there. We've hired a palliative care ARNP, yay! And we've hired a hospice physician. Renee is our ARNP, and she starts January 18th. And Dr. Bowman is our associate medical director hospice physician. So when the surveyor comes, He's our hospice physician because we can only have one medical director, but he currently works in the ED per diem, and so he's joined us, and really happy to have him and to give Dr. Madden a break because he is beyond busy. A couple other things, we have representation on WSHPCO, so it's the state, Washington State Hospice Palliative Care Organization. I worked with them to develop this. This is a palliative care roadmap, so that was really great, and it's a resource that we can give to our patients as we start building that palliative care program. And I was just elected to the board in December, so I'll be sitting on their board for the next couple of years, which is going to be really good for our program. And then we restructured our department, which was huge, and I'll get there in a minute. Okay, next slide, please. Next slide. So I just wanted to give you a brief look at where we are. So the 2019 are the green and the 2020 is the blue. You will see that if you look at the 2019 line, the end of the year, there was an uptick. Now it's interesting because that uptick pretty much correlates with when we went live in from NetSmart into Epic. And so I'm not quite sure how that transition happened, if we just got busier, but that immediate up is where we went live in Epic. So I'm thinking that there's an association there, but the general trend on the lines are the same. So you can draw that conclusion as well. Next slide, please. Length of stay. So this is a big one for us, and we're going to talk about the, I think we're going to get to the budget in one of the next slides, but we have been over budget all year. So for the last, 11 months, because we haven't hit the end of December yet. And a big part of that is that our length of stay has risen, which is really great. So if you look at the national length of stay, it's 89 days. Our length of stay is 51. So it's still much lower than the average, but it is starting to go up. And that is what is helping our bottom line. Hospice is paid by the day, right? So we get about $196 every day we have someone on services. What we know is that the most expensive care is at the very beginning when we're bringing someone on and managing those symptoms and when they're passing, right? And they need all of that additional care. When you have those middle days, then that's where you, and I'm going to say this, and that's where you make your money. I mean, right? That's where you're making the money that's going to pay for your staff, your DME, your supplies, all of those things, and allow you to keep your lights on. So as we increase the length of stay, it increases those kind of in-between days, which is really good for us. That is partly what we're seeing here as we look at our budget. Next slide, please. If we look at where our biggest expenditures are, it's in staffing, particularly in hospice. It's the same in home health. Supplies probably come in a closer second, but staffing for sure in hospice, and that includes benefits and travel because our clinicians are out on the road. You would be amazed at how much money I spend on mileage. The hospital, the organization spends on mileage. Purchase services, LCC is Life Care Center, so we contract with them to provide respite care. It's the care that is provided to family members when they just need a break from caring for their loved one. Jefferson Healthcare, we spend a lot of money on Jefferson Healthcare with patients wanting labs and tests and going to their doctors and things like that. And for me, that's partly where that education comes in on curative versus palliative. SHP is a scrubber that we use for documentation. North Star are triage services, DME. Largest revenue areas, Medicare is 88%, Medicaid is 7%, and then other insurance is about 5%. Next slide, please. And this is just showing where we are in our budget. And you can see that we've had a really good year. Now, I will tell you that home health has not had a really good year. And so when I look at this, I often look at the two together and how are they balancing each other out. But if we look specifically at our program, hospice is doing well. Next slide, please. These are our AR days. And this is a graph. It doesn't really speak to the days. We're currently at 77.1. But in October, we were at 109. So we're making really big strides. It's important to note that in October of 2019, when we went live with Epic, we also assumed responsibility back of our billing. Hospice home health billing is very different than traditional healthcare billing. It's the codes are different. The type of billing is just different. And so we brought it back on thinking that we might be able to manage it. I was a little bit worried at first, but we're getting there. So those are slowly coming down. And Crystal, who is our office specialist, has really taken hold of this and managed it and is doing a fabulous job. She tells me she doesn't want to be a biller, but she knows an awful lot. And so she's managing that and is doing a great job. Things that hold up billing. So unsigned CTIs, unsigned orders, unsigned plans of care, waiting on insurance approval, waiting on medications to enter into the bill, those all add up. The other piece that's a challenge for us is that hospice is absolutely sequential, right? So we have benefit periods in hospice, and we cannot bill for the second benefit period until we've billed for the first. So if we have an order that we're waiting to get signed for whatever reason, and the second one is ready to be billed, we have everything we need, we can't bill it until we have the first one. We have to wait till it's been completely processed, which can take 2 to 3 weeks, and then we can bill it. So if you get backed up, it's a snowball effect. So 77.1, we're pretty happy about that. Next slide, please. So just some real quick quality. Overall, our hospice has seen some really great improvements. You'll see that here, although there are still areas that need to be worked on. One of the challenges we face is that our numbers, that N number, is often small. And so when you get a bad one, it really can skew what you're looking at. But then you have to go back and say, well, okay, that may be true, but why did I get that really bad one, right? So it doesn't change the percentage at all, but we do take a look at that as well. So that was this one. Next slide, please. And this just speaks to more of what we're working on. Areas of specific focus right now, we're working on symptom management. Maybe this one, the next slide, that speaks directly to that. We're also working on service intensity add-on, infection control, and supply management to get a better task handle on our supplies. And next slide. And just a quick explanation here on this one. These numbers are not so pretty, and obviously there's work to do on these. These are measures that we choose to look at. These are not Medicare measures that are looked at nationally. These are ones where we think that we maybe don't do a good job in, and we want to get better. And so we are looking at those, and you can see that there's a reason we're looking at them, and we need to continue to work. Work on those. So I just didn't want you to think we were perfect, because we're obviously not. All right, staffing overview, guys. I may have to let you read the rest of this. I apologize. So volunteers, we work with volunteers. So just a quick note on some things that we've done. We have an 1135 waiver right now. So normally hospice volunteers, 5% of hospice hours need to be provided by volunteers. When COVID hit, there was a waiver that came out through Medicare. So since March, we have not had to utilize volunteers. We do have volunteers working. We reintroduced them virtually in November. So they are doing things like reading to people over the phone, helping them with some errands, walking their dog, things like that. I'm going to let you read the rest on your own. Some really great things. But next slide. So employee survey, we had a really low score, and I'm just going to blame it on a couple things. I know it's not all of this, but we have been short-staffed since March. I think our survey was done maybe in June, and so I think our staff was feeling overwhelmed. I'm not trying to place blame other than where it needs to be, but there are reasons. COVID, the constant change of COVID, and wondering, you know, that anxiety and trepidation we talked about, and how do we do this? How do we care for patients? Am I safe? I think that had something to do with it. And then we had just announced our restructure, which kind of hit like a lead balloon. So this is where we are. We did take seriously the results and the comments that we received back, and are actively striving to improve ourselves for the benefit of our staff. Next slide, please. These were our high areas and our low areas. And communication was the takeaway. It's all about communication. Next slide, please. So this, again, these were the hot spots that you can see. Communication was the low point. And it was interesting that it was different in hospice than it was in home health, significantly different. The orange is hospice, and those are lower numbers than in home health. Next slide, please. Areas of focus, communication, obviously. Some things that we're doing, and we had been doing the daily huddles, recording them and posting them on our SharePoint site, and we're still continuing to do that. We've developed a monthly newsletter, as well as a communication board that we keep up all week. I take a picture and then send it on Monday and send it out. Growth and development, and then culture. So, Brittany, I'm at the end of my time. I want to be cognizant of that.
Yes. Tammy? Thank you so much. And we do have the all of the slides in the packet. So I asked you, all the board members, to go ahead and look through the rest of that and read through it. There's a wealth of information there. We've heard a wealth of information, thanks to Tammy. And it looks like we need to plan to schedule for updates and other requirements. Mm-hmm. So we will get with you and do that. And we will look forward to more news about hospice and home health.
Absolutely. And if you're reading through those slides and you have questions, please feel free to reach out to me via email, phone, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have. Boy, I thought 45 minutes was going to be hard to fill, and it just flew by. So thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tammy. Well done. Are there any quick questions from the board?
No, just good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, Jill, this is Mike. I'd like to second that. Not only has Tammy done an incredible job with home health and hospice and really putting that organization on an exciting track, she's been a wonderful contributor to our work with COVID. Our surge plans and our PPE council, and she's a very valued and treasured member of the director team. So thank you, Tammy, for everything that you do.
Thank you. Have a nice holiday, you guys.
And same to you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. All right. At this time, we will conclude the education session, and we will take a break and reconvene at 3:30. Thank you, everyone. Are we on?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome back to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, December 23rd, 2020. We are now entering the business section of the meeting. And it's great pleasure that I turn the meeting over right now to Mike Glenn, because we're going to have the team employee and provider of the quarter. And it's amazing how difficult it is to choose from the staff who have been working tirelessly for all these months. It's really difficult to pare down, but we managed to do it. And so let's have the introductions to the team and provider of the quarter.
So, Commissioner, this is Caitlin. I think I'm going to do it unless there's any concern with that.
No, I'm good with it. I'm just trying to make sense of the visual that we've got going on right now.
I don't think that person works for us.
No. There we go. That's much better. So, so we're a
I think you're muted, Caitlin.
Sorry about that. We're pleased to announce the fourth quarter 2020 winners in our employee team and provider recognition program. These individuals consistently demonstrate our service standards, are an inspiration to others. They're selected for being role models and for going above and beyond during this quarter, and in particular with the folks this time around for this entire year. And they contribute to our excellence. So we'll begin with our employee of the quarter, which partly why I came from vacation was because of this one. Amber received 2 outstanding nominations for her incredible work during the COVID pandemic. She's been on call every weekend and evening since the pandemic began in March. She's not once complained and continues to be positive and a team player, stepping up to help with whatever needs to be done, from fit testing multiple times to processing new hires, our flu shots. In addition to that, of course, all of the tracing we've done every time there's been a COVID positive. Her work has embodied the teamwork principles, and she puts employees and the well-being of the community first in all of her work. So congratulations to Amber Pankow, our employee of the quarter.
Well done.
Next up is our team of the quarter, and it is our PPE council. And Brittany, can we have the next slide? So I'm going to read them real quick. And I'm excited to say that on today is Julia Drew representing this team. This team consistently brings forward innovative ideas to share and communicates if processes need improvement. This open dialogue has increased understanding of protocols, and departments are often adopting best practices from one another. As content experts, our PPE Council has revolutionized what we know about PPE, how we use it, and how we feel about PPE. So please join me in congratulating Jess Sigalotti, Rachel Collins, Arabella Dobenberger, Tisha Davidson, Julia Drew, Cara Ely, Katie Rose Fisher-Price, Callie Fountain, Alice Fox, Shannon Groff, Janelle Harper, Dr. Tracy Harris, Mitzi Hazard, Randy Holman, Jamie Hubler, Larry Koch, Deb Latow, Cara O'Connell, Kelly O'Connell, Andy Peasley, David Sharp, Laura Showers, Andrew Skipper, Jesse Taft, and Tracy Ware. Thank you to all of our people. So the last one, can I get the next slide, Brittany? Are our providers of the quarter. So they're our COVID physician team. So I'll do this in order of their standing, Dr. Steve Butterfield, Dr. Tracy Harris, and Dr. Joe Mattard. The COVID physicians nominators were inspired by their tireless work throughout the pandemic to care for Jefferson Healthcare's patients, staff, and our entire community. Since March, COVID physicians have shared 1 in 3 call to ensure that there's always a COVID physician available for consult, to make key decisions, and to contact positive patients. And I just want to pause on that, because every positive in Jefferson Healthcare has had a physician call them, which it's mind-blowing. They've coordinated surge plans, ensured that staff had enough personal protective equipment, you'll hear PPE lots, and that they know how to use it, led infection control efforts, and helped us to plan for our vaccine administration. Thank you to our 3 COVID physicians.
Great job.
And then, in the spirit of gratitude and recognition, SLG, Jefferson Healthcare, our patients and community want to thank Mike Glenn for his extraordinary leadership during these extraordinary times. Please join me in appreciation of Mike, Amber, Drs. Harris, Mattern, Butterfield, and the entire PPE Council.
Well done, and thank you. Thank you to all of our people being recognized. This is an amazing organization, and it's all because of all of you. And I wish that the community could be here to listen to everything that happens, and all the things that you've done, because it's awesome, fantastic, all the superlatives you can think of. So thank you, everyone. Well deserved. So we will move on now to the minutes of November 25th, regular session, and December 10th, the special session minutes. Is there a motion to approve those?
So move.
Second?
Second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? Then all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay, minutes are passed as presented. We have required approvals. Is there anything that anyone would like to take out of that? If not, then may I have a motion, please, to approve?
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
I'm not hearing a second.
Bruce.
I will
Matt said second.
I will second, but could we have a moment of discussion?
Yes. Now we can have discussion since it's been seconded.
I believe that it's in here, and unfortunately I seem to have lost my notes. That has to do with policies regarding physician assistance. Is that in that section? Is that in the...
Yes.
Okay.
I believe so.
The question that I have is that there's a section that says that in order for a physician assistant to practice remotely, he or she must be authorized apparently by a state board. And then there's another section that says that a physician assistant may practice in a site other than where the primary supervising physician happens to be located, just so long that the physician is readily available by phone. And first, I just want to clarify that my question, I'm delighted that we have as many physician assistants as we do. I have personally many decades of experience with them, and they're phenomenal. But I'm wondering, there just seems to be a little inconsistency there, and I'm wondering whether that has been an issue or how we handle PAs who are in a, quote, remote site or, quote, a site where the provider is not physically located.
Mike, would you have any input on that, or Jennifer, perhaps, or Dr. Mattern, if he's here?
I can chime in on that. So I think, well, first of all, right now, the way that we're set up is that we don't have, in our current format, we don't have PAs in remote sites currently working. So everyone is paired. I think I'd have to kind of take a look at some of the language. There's rural health clinic language around, which does allow from a state standpoint, state guidelines, that does allow a physician assistant working remotely without someone on site. And there's specific language. So I think there's that piece. And then there's kind of our credentialing and sort of how we do things, which is really more of, we've really kind of gone more to the practice share model where PAs are linked. They can be in a clinic, not necessarily with their supervising physician always present, but we do have the availability. Does that help a little bit to maybe explain some of the difference of what you're seeing?
Yes, it does. Let me say, I don't want to hold up approval of this particular document. It's just that I noticed there seemed to be a little discrepancy there. If that's not a problem from your perspective, or there's no significant discrepancy, then I'm perfectly happy to drop.
Yeah, this is something that gets a lot of attention from the credentialing group and discussion at RMAC, and there's been a lot of work to make sure that the language is kind of consistent with what we're doing. So I know it's been looked at, so I don't have the stuff right in front of me to, parse it through, but I will tell you that it's certainly gotten a lot of scrutiny over the last couple of years, because particularly the PA oversight has really been tightened up the last few years to make it clearer kind of how we go about that relationship.
Okay, thank you.
Is there any further discussion on that? All right, then, may I have, I will go ahead and call for the vote. All those in favor of approving the required approval, say aye.
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 Those opposed? All right, they are approved. Thank you. And then we will go right into our financial report with Jim Heilsberg. Am I saying that properly, Jim?
Yes, and right. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Interim CFO, thank you. Go ahead.
So I appreciate the opportunity to present today, and hopefully everybody can hear me okay. And if there's any technical difficulties, then we'll address those. But I'm going to have the slides turned just like the prior presenter. In looking at our financial statement for the month, we'll go to the next slide. Traditionally, we've looked at our statistics, and since our last board meeting and last report, Jefferson Healthcare's took a pretty significant negative turn when we look at our activity, and it was reported we were much closer to budget by the end of the month. You can see mostly we have red areas when I look at our variances for the month. In reality, Jefferson's had kind of a perfect storm event since the last board meeting, that we've had lower than targeted volumes along with higher than normal expenses, some of them, to many of them, COVID related. And then we have a couple items that are adjustments that are one time that have impacted our financials for November. So we're looking at the statistics, but as we get into some of the other financials, and you probably have already looked at those, you're going to see a significantly different picture than what you saw last month when you looked at the look ahead for November. We went from really on target to off target nearly in just about every area right after the last board meeting. And one of the major contributors to that storm really was the holiday week. And it traditionally has lower activity, but the week following that, along with that, really just impacted our financial performance and our activity for the month of November. The activity performance in November in comparison to 2019, while similar, it was even more dramatic than the prior year. So we want to look a little bit more at the detail, but those are kind of some general thoughts of to give you a backdrop of what happened since the last time we gave a look ahead for November. Couple key items as we look at the key areas, and as you noted in the past, that ICU, ACU, and the ED have continued to be lower than budget for the year, and that continued in the month of November. And there's many month-to-date variances that are negative, there are some key variances that are closer to budget that support our bottom line, and the most notable for those are really in the surgery area and the specialty clinics. Their strong performance really did help us and support our other negative areas that happen. Our year-to-date variances for all statistics are, you know, similar to the prior month, but November's impact can be seen if you look more closely. And looking into the future, the bright spot is as we look in December, we see trends that are much more consistent with what we've had in the prior year. And December historically does have a lot of positives relating to surgery activity as people try to use up their deductibles and copays. And we see that again in the first part of December and expect that to happen in the last part of December as well. So next slide. In looking at our income statement, you can definitely see the perfect storm come through from the activity, and it shows up in our revenue. And really, we'll talk about those three specific areas where we see the impact. The first one is our revenue. Second one will be the contractual adjustments in charity care. And then we'll spend a little bit of time talking about our expenses. Each have their own unique components, but each is significantly contributing to the November performance. Revenue for the month is very consistent with variances we've seen in the statistics. The inpatient revenue variance combined with our negative outpatient variance, like surgery, were contributors to a lower than budgeted revenue variance. November really has dampened the last several months of improvement. And again, we were looking to December to help rebound from this, but November was uniquely different in how it did impact our overall for the year. Our net patient revenue, I want to talk just a little bit. You can see that there is a 7% positive variance. Much of that comes from the Medicare contribution and how we are paid with our cost report and that payment methodology. But what you don't see in this slide is really that there is a significant change that has been happening, but really is impacting in the month of November relating to our insurance clients and also our self-pay clients that we serve. When we look at that more closely, what we see and have seen is a trend, but we're really seeing a continued trend of insurance payments that are worsening because we have more governmental-backed insurance plans that are paying at a worse level than what we had been experiencing. And we have less insurance payments coming from normal insurance plans. And the end result is a decrease in that we believe will be carrying forward into the future, or at least the near future. Then combined with that, you can see that our charity care is significantly higher. And the reason for that is that that actually is a part of that reason is that we are now classifying our self-pay portion that we're writing off that traditionally went to bad debt. It is being coded into the charity care bucket or in that category, primarily due to a change relating to a regulation. So we're continuing to monitor that, but that variance really can be tied back to what you've been hearing about is the need to write off more the decision made that we're not going to be sending people to collection relating to their balances. And so that's showing up in that category. When we look at our other revenue,
Could I ask, go ahead. As you're going, is it okay if we ask a question here or there?
Absolutely.
Okay, this is Case again. So the charity care adjustments, I didn't understand the first part of that. Are those being reported or recorded in a different way? I heard you say that there was some change in how it was recorded, but also that there is an additional amount of charity care.
I think it's more accurate to say there's more of a change in how it's being reported that's increasing that category. So we have bad debt being recorded in that category at this point based on a change that's occurred that we planned on giving more of an update next month on.
Okay, so I'll learn more about that change in regulations and how that's allocated and where that was previously recorded next month. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes. And the previous place it was reported is in the bad debt category, which would have shown up under net patient services revenue, if I'm correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Mike, do you have any comment on that you want to chime in on?
Yeah, we were planning on addressing charity care in a much more substantial way at the next meeting because there have been some policy adjustments that will likely carry forward. The first policy adjustment is that we ceased sending any account to collections, I think, back in March. So that has impacted our accounts receivable, and we are making some decisions now on kind of the collectability of that. And then what we will talk about in January is sort of what the go forward revised policy will look like with respect to charity care. So I think it'll be an interesting discussion that I'll take you through next month.
Jim, may I ask, it's Mari Dressler. When you say there is less commercial insurance, is that do you have any ideas because of employment job losses that where they had insurance with their employment and because of COVID, they now are more reliant on Medicaid and charity care?
I think I'll make a couple comments and then Mike will join in. We're still researching that to clarify, but there is I think more of a state and national trend that there's more people that do not have the same insurance benefits they had. And we've looked at some data this month as I've come in, but we're continuing to look deeper at that to validate some thoughts we have. But what you said, I think, is part of the puzzle. We just want to get more data to actually confirm that before we make any real blanket statements. But Mike, did you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, I guess there's a couple of things to help connect the dots, Mari, that there's things that we know and things that we suspect. What we know and the adjustment that Jim was explaining with respect to our revenue adjustment is that if you think about all of our insurance companies and the variations of policies within each of those agreements with insurance companies, they constantly come up for renewal. And, you know, usually we fight the good fight. And if we get paid at 77% of charges, we knock heads with them to try to keep that at 77% of charges and maybe even higher. Well, what has happened over the last year is that the amount that they are paying us has decreased at a greater rate than we projected. So what we know is that the index of all of our insurance companies are paying us less than they have been paying us and than what we projected, what we think. And it's based, I think this is where your question is coming from, Mari. What we think is that based on the economic decline in the country, the state, this region, that there will very likely be a decline in commercially insured patients in our community and likely more people moving to Medicaid. And maybe no insurance. But that's the part that we don't really have a feel for yet. And lastly, the reason that we are talking about this is that when one of the last things that Hillary did before she left is that because whenever these revenue adjustments, they are just their projections. The contractual adjustments are models that based on how you think you're going to get paid, the difference between what you bill and what you're going to get paid, you attach an adjustment to that, and then that's how you record your income statement. And then every 3 to 6 months, you do an audit to see if your projections are accurate. And what happened this month is that Hillary and her team concluded that the projection for the contractual allowance with our commercial insurance was overstated, and when that and it needed to be adjusted, and not only just adjusted going forward, but adjusted going backwards and attached to all of the accounts receivable of commercial insurance in our system. So the net result of that, and you know, a big part of Jim's perfect storm is a $900,000 adjustment to the commercially insurance contractual allowance that was booked in this month. Mm-hmm. So which is contributing in big fashion to the $1.6 million change in net position.
Wow, it's a real challenge for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we talk about expenses? This is a significant variance for the month and as we look forward, so it's notable and any questions are good.
Thank you.
If you have any as we go along, feel free to ask them coming back to this, but we'll talk a little bit about expenses now. Looking at expenses. So as much as the revenue and the contractuals had an impact, combined with that, we've had some one-time expenses that really relate to prior months. And we'll talk about each one specifically. I forgot that I didn't mention on the other revenue, one of the other contributors were looking at other revenue were under budget. And those have been, I think, over budget as you look at the year to date traditionally, but in the and much of that relates to the grant funding that we've had. But in the current month, we did have a decrease in our 340B, our cafeteria, and our retail pharmacy in comparison to budget. So that is contributing mostly to the negative variance for other revenue. And looking at our expenses, so there really were the first area is looking at our salary and wages. And we did have a adjustment that we made, an accrual equivalent or adjusting for what will happen in the future relating to the Family Medical Leave Act. So we have to anticipate and put dollars on the books that allow us to, when people take leave for that plan under that regulation, that we have the dollars available, and then they're recorded against that. So the impact of that is in November, but it really relates to earlier in the year, and it just happened to have been identified and put in this month. And that's really part of your variance that you see there between our budget and actual. The other part is related to, I think, just the month-to-month budget. And when I looked at the dollars after I take out that amount relating to the adjustment for the State Family Medical Leave Act, it was pretty close to the prior month total. So you have a holiday and other things. The wages, salary and wages, were pretty close in my mind to where we'd been in the prior month. Employee benefits had a different type of adjustment. It actually was the opposite way. There was an over-accrual of retirement-related adjustment in the last month, and the impact of that reversing decreased our benefits for the month slightly, so it shows under budget. And then finally, the other major items are in the other expense category. The first one is that we have had and continue to have around the $300,000 amount relating to COVID test costs relating to the lab. And so those are extra costs we pay for processing those that we wouldn't have had. And the other large one is I'm attributing it to being related to supply expense that likely is related to the month of October. Had they both been taken out, or had the supply or drug expense been taken out in the month of November, put mostly back to October, combined with all the other things, we'd be looking at a loss that is much closer to a break-even standpoint for the month of November, even in spite of the fact of the lower revenue and contractual adjustment. Any questions on those? That's a lot. It is, as we look at this, they are significant in one time, but they made for the perfect storm of a presentation relating to how do we look at the November income statement and its performance in context of everything else. So I'll move on, and a couple other items. One bright spot is looking at the non-operating revenue. That is going to be our property taxes that we're collecting in the month that are greater than what we had budgeted. Traditional this time of year to be catching up on some of those. And then I would say that the other, in looking at the net income, if you don't look at what we already did and talked about, that the net income or loss is pretty overwhelming. But we have looked at it. We are looking at what we will see in December, and looking forward to what has already been a good month. And we have every expectation that it should be a good month. And I think differently than in November, when we look and saw a good month, we're not seeing as many signs of what we could see that it would happen in December that would do anything like November. Next slide. Looking at cash and AR, you do see up on the lines of cash that we do have a decrease in our cash occurring over a number of months. We also have, we'll report on the last slide, that we did get a payment from Medicare for the 2019 cost report settlement. That amount is going to increase our days in cash from 156 closer to the 169. So a $2.8 million payment helps our cash, and that is a good thing. We also will talk about it as a look ahead, some other things that are coming in the future, but for right now, that's a major contributor. And then looking at our AR days, we're continuing to be in that 45 to 50 AR day range. We are continuing to work on and improve in the area of revenue cycle, recruiting for a person. But since coming in and carrying the torch from Hillary and others, we're working diligently to try to improve in that area. Next slide.
Jim, can I ask about the, we've got this Medicare, or is it CARES loan to pay back, right?
Yes.
Which is included in the days of cash on hand?
Correct.
Okay, so we do expect that to go down significantly in the next few months?
Yes, if we choose to pay it back in its entirety, then we will see a significant decrease from that. And if you pay it back over time, there's different ways you can do it with limited impact. So it's really trying to determine how much hassle do you want and how much do you need the cash.
Hillary's showing it as two lines. The 156 line includes the...
And the 102 is without.
102 and the 102 number is the line that I stare at, and that also will be increased by $2.8 million receivable as well. We are advocating, when I say we, it's the all hospitals, but particularly public hospital or rural hospitals are advocating for some of that advanced payment debt to be forgiven.
Sure.
As part of a maybe 2021 CARES Act for a brief and shining moment. It was included in the discussion around the most recent CARES Act that was passed and vetoed and probably will be passed again. But it's something that Derek Kilmer and the rest of our congressional delegation understands would be a great thing. And we're not counting on it, but we will hold on to that debt probably as long as it makes sense.
Great. Thank you.
So let's go to the next slide. And board financial report, understanding that this kind of just a review of the those in expense items relating to the board's duties and what occurs there. And in looking at this, there's a very small minor variance relating to wages and benefits. It's most likely due to a 31 compared to a 30-day month. We decreased the wages in a 30-day month, but nothing significant there. And the year-to-date numbers, as I heard reported last month, consistent thoughts relating to what was reported last month, and the variances are due to timing more than anything else. Next slide. So this is where we really do have, I believe, the good news as we look at the future. And the first one is that we see our charges that are projected, and we're at 101.7% of budget. We expect that to continue through the rest of the month. It can be dampened slightly by Christmas Eve and Christmas, but we do believe that we're going to see a positive result there. And our collections continue to be a little bit lower than anticipated. We are continuing to see our AR days go up and down slightly. And you can see there the 44.7 days that are listed there. There is I think that's the difference, if I understand it, between what you see on the other screen, and that is really due to Epic, what we have available. But there's some differences that happen on this slide in comparison to what you already saw. And then finally, the $2.8 million already talked about is mentioned here on this slide. And as Mike alluded to, there's also some additional funding that we're looking to have come in December, first quarter of 2021, relating to both the CARES funding and then from the state level, as also some local jurisdiction funding that will help improve our performance when we actually get those. So with that, I think that's all I have, unless there are questions.
Any questions from the board? All right, then. Thank you, Jim. Here's to December's budget coming in.
Yeah, I think November.
Yeah, sorry that this report was not the best report, not one that I love to give as a first report to the board.
November reminded us that we are, even though we are doing a lot of public health work, we are a slave to the private business healthcare market. And if you're, you know, if revenues don't show up, you get crushed. And that is what happened. And in addition to, you know, a few of those adjustments, but it got our attention. And And I would probably be more anxious if this December looked foreboding as well. But December looks okay, and you know, we have line of sight on getting out of all of this and going back to being focused on growing services.
Well, we were in a good position before November, and I think that, you know, that speaks well to that we're not any further down than we appear to be in November. So we can only do, you know, with what we can, and I think we've done an exemplary job through this crisis so far. We're in much better position than many, many other hospitals our size. Thank you. So we will move on then to the quality report with Brandy Manuel, our Chief Patient Safety and Quality Officer.
Hi, thank you. So I'm going to go ahead and see if I can steer it from my end. Today's report, we're going to take a quick look at just kind of how things are going in the patient safety and quality world. As always, we will take a look at what our patients are saying, and then we'll close out with just a high-level reminder of some of the things that occurred in 2020. And I want to give a quick shout out to our friends from the Sunfield Farm and Waldorf School. You'll see some artwork throughout these slides that was courtesy of their students, who sent a package of beautiful cards and letters to our frontline healthcare workers to thank them for all that they've done during COVID. So I hope you guys get a chance to enjoy them. All right, so starting with our standard scorecard, we did have two patient falls last month. One of them occurred in an outpatient area. The other one was an inpatient. Both of them had kind of a temporary harm is where we would categorize it. One of them was a scrape, and the other one was a bump on the skin that was resolved, and there was no permanent harm from that. The rest of our performance continued to do well. We did well with our core measure compliance, which was great. Unfortunately, we had two employees that were harmed as a result of workplace violence in November. So one of them was bitten, and another one had their hair pulled and a necklace broken. Both of those happened with patients who were confused and not intending to cause harm, but did in fact create an injury for a couple of our employees. Readmissions continue to be right around 10% compared to our statewide average of 12%. So doing well there as well. And if we take a dive, when we talk about those patient safety metrics, this is what lives underneath that metric. And you can see overall, not a lot has changed, which is a good thing because we're sitting at zero in most of these areas. So adverse drug events continue along the same lines, no real changes. Antimicrobial stewardship, our days of therapy are down, which is good. Falls with injury also down, even with the fall that we reported. And then everything else is kind of remaining right around the same. Central line days did go up, but there were no harm events associated with those central lines. So even though it looks like a red upward arrow here, it is just appropriate for the course of care for those particular patients. Taking a look at service excellence. So we have a really high goal for looking at and measuring service excellence. Our goal is that all of our departments will reach the top quartile or better. And while we're not there across the entire house, we are there in three different areas. And as Tammy mentioned, I'm glad she mentioned it earlier, hospice has made great improvements, and they're currently sitting at about the 99th percentile ranking, which is incredible. The hospital is at in the 92nd, and the emergency department is in the 90th percentile ranking. So that's really, really good. We have a handful of others that are not quite in their target range, but most of them have made improvements consistently, even in the era of COVID. And I put an asterisk next to ambulatory surgery because this particular report is reflecting a rolling 90-day period. However, if we look at the current quarter, which is still in progress, they're actually, they would be considered meeting target. So we're going to keep an eye on them. But what you see over to the right-hand side is our HCAHPS score. This is reflective of our inpatient data and how they've performed over the last while. This is the one that is publicly reported. And so when we talk about the star rating through CMS, this is what gets calculated there. The rest of them are made available, but they are not required reporting. And you can see the upward trend there as well. And if we pause here to take a moment and reflect on the words of our community and our patients, a couple of folks jumped out at us, Dr. Vorsinger, Dr. Eisman. COVID continues to play a role in the patient perception and decisions around care. So we had a couple of comments that reflected sort of where people were at. Certainly, it impacts the visitor policies. Unfortunately, we have to limit visitation during this time of COVID, and that's a hard thing for our patients. So our IT and our clinical informatics teams and our bedside clinicians work really hard to make sure that we have the technology in place to still bring visitors in whatever way we can as safely as possible. But it certainly isn't the same as having someone there to hold your hand, and that's understandable. And one of my favorite comments in looking at kind of the last couple of weeks is the one in red at the bottom. I'd like to thank the doctors, staff, and nurses for taking such great care of me. I feel lucky to have had my emergency occur in Port Townsend. I left my gallbladder in PT and gained admiration for the care I was provided at Jefferson, which I thought was really sweet. And let's see. All right. And then, like I mentioned earlier, it's really easy when you live in this world to think that everything we do is COVID, all the time. And that wouldn't be really far off. That's pretty close. But I think it's important sometimes to take a step back and remember that there's a lot that we do that isn't COVID. And as it turns out, we take really great care of our patients and we work hard on other things. So in taking a step back, here are just a few of the things that happened in 2020 when we weren't talking about COVID, or maybe while we were. So just a reminder, we had recognition from the American Heart Association for heart failure, for diabetes, for stroke. We received the Performance Leadership Award from the National Organization of the State Offices of Rural Health for our outcomes. We again received the Healthcare Equality Index Leader Award. We not only had our standard DNV survey, but we also had our ISO recertification year this year. So a pretty in-depth survey there. We also added one more certification to our list, our certification in infection prevention. And we finished out the year by participating in an antimicrobial stewardship program with Johns Hopkins and AHRQ, which was really exciting. And then also we were awarded one of the best hospitals, the Women's Choice Award for outpatient experience by the American College of Surgeons. So just in case we forget about all the other cool things that happen on a day-to-day basis, I wanted to kind of remind us and say thank you to everybody who works so hard every single day to make all of those things come together. So that's really all that I have for you. What questions do you have?
Questions from the board?
Yeah, I do have one question, Case here. Remarkable list of achievements. Is there anything left that we can go for in 2021, or have we come to the end of the road?
Oh, no, there's never the end of the road. There are a couple of other things that we can work on. And so we're kind of looking at the options available. DNV actually has a couple of other certifications that are interesting. Each one of those comes with a cost, of course, but we also feel like they make us a better organization and they up our game a little bit. So we're looking at those and talking with DNB to prioritize and move forward in 2021 with maybe another dot.
And if I could just add one additional comment, and I don't think you mentioned this. I think also our signing a contract with the Institute for Health Improvement is also a significant milestone and an enormous beginning of an effort to deal with quality in terms of dealing with racism and health equity.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're really excited about that and expect that to really pick up here in the next month or so.
Thank you, Brandy. That excellent report and uplifting. So thank you for that as well.
Brandy, and if I could say something too, that when in your travels around the organization, please convey the thanks certainly from myself and I assume the other board members for the sterling work that has been happening, not only COVID, which is remarkable, but they've carried on and done so well in all other aspects of the care and that they deliver to our community members. So from a retired nurse, please tell them they're in my heart because they've worked hard.
Absolutely. Thank you. I will be sure and share that message. And it really is humbling to work alongside our bedside clinicians here. They're amazing.
So, Mari, if I could chime in again, as the secretary of the board, what do you think about a letter from the board to all of the staff?
I have suggested that actually just about a month or so ago, and we will do one, I think, for the end of the year in recognition.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Brandy.
Thank you.
Then we will move on. And next we have Mike Glenn, our CEO, the administrative report. Mike.
Right. So, Brittany, could you pull that up? You make it big.
There you go. I'm glad I'm not the only one that has it.
Next slide, please. I wanted to give you a brief update on our COVID testing status. My presentation is going to be briefer than normal because Dr. Mattern was able to join us today, and he is going to give you a more extended update on kind of all things COVID. Lots more of this coming after my presentation. So you have probably seen numbers similar to this either recorded into the in the paper or elsewhere, but our percentage positive continues to track significantly lower than adjacent counties and certainly the state and national level. A 1.3 a couple of months ago would have been alarming to us, but frankly the trend line has plateaued and I think we feel pretty positive about where Jefferson County is right now. We don't seem to be having any issues related to finding space at the hospital. A couple of weeks ago, we were having issues finding space in Bremerton and Seattle for sicker than we are comfortable taking care of patients that required sending out. In talking with the house supervisor today, that situation has gotten a little bit better, and we've been managing to place our most sick patients without too much complication. Next slide. So given Jim's presentation, I wanted to take you through our volumes for most of December. And again, these are the dates at the bottom of the slide represent the week's beginning. So it takes us all the way to the end of last week. And I mean, really, I think that you look at the slide furthest to the left, and that pretty much describes November. And then the slides to the right of the tables represent a busier December. And what we just have to accept is that you know, as we grow our volumes, we add a lot of staff to take care of those patients. So that's kind of a variable level, but also all of the supporting work that that comes from that additional work. Well, when volumes for whatever reason don't show up, all of that additional staffing that you have in place to accommodate the direct and indirect expenses associated with that projected volume does. So that I think is probably the most important reason why we pay attention to this stuff, because hitting our revenue number allows us to hit our expense number, which we like to do. So primary care at over 100% the last 2 weeks, and you know, this is in addition to the res clinic and the testing apparatus that is going on. So good job there. And then the specialty clinic is also extraordinarily busy, and it's not too uncommon that you see this in December because of deductibles being met. And if folks do have some discretion on when to have their procedures done, they would prefer to do it in December and not have to pay a copay rather than January and do.
Next. Can I ask a question about that slide?
Sure.
So I'm looking at the primary care side, and I'm seeing the video appointments as a relatively substantial percentage of the volume. Is that something that we, two questions, is that something that we anticipate will continue that way? And number two is, are those visits reimbursed at this point? What's the finance side of that picture?
Well, I think that represents, you know, what is that, about a 10 to 15% of total visits number, which we probably do expect to continue seeing. I'll ask Jen to chime in if she has a comment on that. And while there is reimbursement now for video appointments, it's not on par with in-person appointments. And the good news is that there's reimbursement, but the not so good news is that there's probably more overhead required to do an effective video appointment than an in-person appointment. So we will keep doing it because our patients, right now, because it's safer, and I think our patients are some are prefer and are choosing that form of a visit. But we will also continue to advocate in DC and Olympia for reimbursement levels that, you know, allow us to expand those programs. So Jen Wharton, if you're still on the line, any additional comments?
No, I would just echo what you say. It's, you know, around 13%. We've been hovering about the same percentage of that's both video or phone visits in there, as well as you can see the different colors of green, I guess that would be. And Mike is right, there is no parity of payments for specific payers, especially in a rural health clinic. So you can see that most of these video or phone visits are taking place in primary care, which is an RHC that's significantly less reimbursement than our encounter rate. There is, to my knowledge at this moment, no change in reimbursement for the next coming quarter or so that I have read.
Thank you.
All right, next slide, please. Surgical case variance to target. Again, same story. End of November, bad. Most of December, good. And this is important for us, particularly as, you know, as if we do see a decline in our payer mix, and if commercially insured patients pay us less. You all understand the business model of a critical access hospital. Medicare and Medicaid pay you at or below your costs, you make that up with commercial insurance. So if the premium above your costs of the commercial insurance piece reduces and the amount of commercial insurance that you have reduces, that will jeopardize our ability to continue to grow services that are more community health minded than business and bottom line minded. But lots of surgery procedures in December, so that is good news. Next slide, please. And then this is the emergency department and express clinic, I have been continuing to watch this just out of curiosity, is to see if we're seeing a COVID related a shift in use of these services or just something greater, because before now I was able to. You know, you look back to the first of the year and see high numbers, and you think, well, that's winter, and we normally see more patients in winter than we do in spring, summer, and fall. So that explains why we were so much busier then, in addition to pre-COVID. But now we're almost at the point where we're comparing December to a December, and those volumes are significantly lower than what we have been seeing, particularly the Express Clinic, and it's just sort of interesting to watch. So it's a great service right now, and they're doing a wonderful job, we're pleased that they are there to take care of the community. Next slide, please. So this is Dr. Madden's cue that I'm going to turn it over to him in a couple of seconds, but we are blessed with having an incredible group of employees here that do really cool work in charting our metrics, charting our performance standards, and just basically pulling data that allows us to be able to look forward and with some clarity. Josh Brocklesby in IT and Sean in data and Dunya in population health and just a whole bunch of other folks. I'm sure I'm leaving people out. We throw out this, but wouldn't it be nice if we were able to, you know, track our vaccination doses and keep track on a daily basis of how many we have on hand, how many patients we vaccinated and where, and are they employees, are they not employees? And then Dunya takes that back to her team and the next day we have incredible scorecards, and even to the point where Providence, and in some cases even Epic, Wisconsin Epic, contacted Providence, and they contacted Jefferson Healthcare because they wanted to know how we had created this scheduling interface between Epic and our ability to stick a link in an email and have patients schedule their vaccination. So it's not only work that we're impressed by, but the folks at Providence and even the folks at Epic Wisconsin are also impressed by it. And it makes our work so much easier to have, you know, a windshield that's fairly clear and you can look out of. So that's mostly just a thanks so much for the great work of the data team. And with that, I'm gonna turn this over to Joe to have him walk you through it, and then just start to talk a little bit about our COVID response. So, Joe, you there?
I am here. Does everyone can hear me okay?
Yep.
Great. Okay. So, I thought for my report, usually I give you kind of the CMO potpourri rundown, but it's really all things COVID right now. So I thought what I'd do is just quickly, I'll just give you a little update on epidemiology, kind of what we're seeing locally, and then I think probably spend the majority of the time just talking to you about vaccines. So I'll give you a little kind of intro into the vaccine, but I thought maybe a good part of the time might just be, because I could talk about this for 5 minutes, or I could talk about it for about 150 minutes probably on the vaccine side, because it's been pretty all-consuming recently. So I'll stop at some point and you guys can just kind of pepper me with questions, and we can kind of do things that way. So just real quick on the situation with COVID around the state right now. Some good news statewide that the numbers have trended down a bit, particularly in the Western Washington region. Some of you may be aware that the state health officer, Kathy Lofi, Dr. Lofi's leaving at the end of the year. So I got her last epidemiology report this week at a statewide web meeting. And so she was cautiously optimistic that things were trending down in the overall numbers, the percent positive across the state. There's definitely still a lot of hot spots across the state, and we're still very much as a state, though, you know, I like Washington's position given the winter surge compared to some other states, but we're really in a very fragile position overall as a state, because the numbers have been higher than they've ever been, and while they're on a downward trend, if we see another surge like we saw through November on top of the point where we're at right now, it really could put significant stress on hospital systems and resources and stretch us to a point that yet, you know, we had not seen across the state. And I think you look further south down to California and what's taking place down there, and their capacity and certainly other areas in the South. So it is definitely a tenuous time. It's good to be a Jefferson County resident is what I would say right now. You're probably aware of this, that the numbers have trended down for us. We have a steady trickle of positives, but it's been every once a week, you're probably aware that the health department calculates our rate of infections per 100,000 over the previous 14 days. And 25 to 75 is considered a moderate risk number. And we hadn't been in that range since this surge. And I think along with maybe San Juan County, we're probably only, two of the counties that fall in there. So we fell below 75. We've had a few positives this week. So, and we'll have to kind of see how the numbers go through the weekend. So we could very easily pop up back above 75 again. But we're in a place right now where overall the prevalence in the community is, better than other places in Washington right now. We've seen a fair number of positives of people who have, again, had out-of-county or out-of-state contacts, or also within households. I think an important number that you should be aware of, and so when I talk to people about our response, you know, I do speak with some pride just about the county as a whole. Like, I think if you were going to look across the country, and I think when this is all over with, you know, people will ask the question of who did well with this and who didn't. I think you would really look at our county to date, knock on some wood, and say, you know, that was a place that did it right. And, you know, one of the things was it's a close working relationship with your health department and rapid testing and contact tracing. We talked about that from the beginning. And I had a conversation last weekend with one of our public health nurses, and she had informed me that they had run some numbers, and I think the number was something like 40% of people who had positive results, they were already in quarantine before they got their positive result back. And that is the result of contact tracing and getting people in isolation, testing rapidly, and that is what limits spread through your community. And so so kudos to all the people. That's everyone from, you know, COVID hotline team to people swabbing to all those people working long hours, making phone calls from public health and the contact tracers and our COVID team. And, you know, they're really working well together to keep the community prevalence down. So hopefully, and, you know, the other thing too, again, is we really continue to get a strong sense that the community, you know, other things of reasons why we've been successful, the community recognize this is a big deal. They've you know, joined us in this, you know, process to make it better. And so I think you've got people who really adhere to social distancing and mask use and all the things that we've been talking about for so long. So kudos to everyone. It shows that you can, you know, control this thing even when you're seeing surges kind of all around us. So and you always need a little bit of luck. You always want a little bit of luck too. So that's the epidemiology of what we're seeing. Mike kind of mentioned a little bit about hospital capacity around the region. So that has improved a bit through the last week. We've been fine on hospital capacity. We have not had to cut back on surgeries or procedures. We have watched that, and we are very careful to make sure that we manage our beds appropriately. And so when our numbers get up, we have good discussions and planning, and we get teams together. And we've recently pulled together representatives from the inpatient medicine team and surgery. And Tina Toner, as our chief nursing officer, has helped really make sure that people are bought into what our bed management plan is. So we have things in place, and we take it very seriously. So we have good things to maintain capacity. So really, actually, it's been kind of all-consuming, but actually has been quite enjoyable. Maybe not for Jen Wharton, who has to operationalize this, as well as Jake Davidson. They're on the line too, so they're probably rolling their eyes as I say enjoyable. But it is really nice to work on vaccine, because for the first time, I think, in this pandemic, it feels good to be working on something that feels like the solution. What is going to get us kind of out of the pandemic and move us forward, as opposed to just maintain control keep things from getting out of hand. So it feels good to be in that solution space, but it's been a lot of work. And I just want to say that whatever I tell you about the vaccine planning team right now, it is a team. So it'll be me talking, but I just want to recognize that particularly Jen Wharton, Jake Davidson, Jamie Hubler, I'm not going to kind of get everyone's, you know, names on here. The folks from IT, the folks from facilities who are creating a drive-up vaccine station. There's a lot of people involved to make this happen, and a lot of leadership on a lot of levels. And also just a commitment from leadership here to say, we are going to attack this, you know, vaccine delivery like we've attacked the rest of this, which is it's going to be our number one priority, and we're going to do it well, and we're going to be a leader in the community, and we're going to do the heavy lift. So I just want to, you know, say that, you know, before I kind of tell you more about this. I think you guys are all familiar with the fact that, you know, we have the Pfizer vaccine was the first approved with the EUA, and now the Moderna has been approved. We put our name in and got our application in to be a vaccine provider for the state and be recognized by the DOH that we were going to be a site. So we were part of the early distribution, one of the first distribution sites for the Pfizer vaccine, and we received 975 doses. That's a 5-dose per vial, kind of what is expected. We can talk a little bit about this whole idea of the 6th dose in a vial and what we're doing around that. But so we received that. We do have the ultra cold freezer, so we have the logistics to support the cold chain and preservation of the virus, and we've got the protocols in place. And so once we were designated a site, we knew it was coming. We really put the infrastructure in place early on, recognizing that the main goal was going to be the 1A population, and that has been the focus of our work so far. 1A being healthcare workers, that doesn't mean healthcare provider. That's not just healthcare providers. That's healthcare workers. So that's not simply just a nurse or a physician. It's also the other folks who, you know, that can be security, emergency room techs, laboratory staff. There's a broader definition of who, including environmental services, people who clean and are in spaces that could potentially be occupied by patients who have COVID. So we began identifying not just who qualified as the 1A for our own organization, but also as a county vaccine provider, who else would qualify as 1A within our community. And so in working with the health department, we were able to collaborate and identify who else would fall under this 1A umbrella. That includes some private clinics, that includes absolutely workers at long-term care facilities. There is a plan separately that the state has for vaccination of long-term care residents, and we can talk about that if you want, but right now the focus has been primarily on the workers. And so about one week ago, we began our soft rollout of vaccinations for our employees and then for community partners. And I think going into tomorrow, the numbers that I've received is we're anticipating that out of when you look at the umbrella of who is eligible in the 1A category, the number actually goes above 1,000 for not just our employees. Our employees is about 670 who fall in that 1A category. That's not all of our employees. Not all of our employees actually fall in the 1A category, but of the ones that do, that number reaches about 670. Then in the community, there's probably about an additional 400 plus. We're anticipating vaccinating upwards of about 800 people by kind of Christmas Eve. Of that, the most recent numbers, we think the projection at this point, it's a little bit, kind of have to, you know, solidify the numbers kind of on the back end after it happens, but we believe that will be about 600 of the 670 of our employees that are eligible. We think about 70% will have been vaccinated by Christmas Eve, which is if you told me that a week and a half ago, I would have told you that I would be ecstatic, and so I'm kind of ecstatic if that turns out to be the case. We have been vaccinating in two locations. We have been doing drive-up vaccination. This has worked particularly well for community members, particularly community members who have, there is a screen for if we have a concern for allergic reactions or any other, kind of concerns, someone who's maybe, had problems with injections in the past. We give them the option for also in-person. So we've been using the Dirksen conference room that's been turned into the vaccine station. And so we've been able to set up a very efficient process. It's been very easy to schedule. So Mike mentioned the scheduling interface that we can use, where we use one application for kind of the scheduling on the front end that's patient facing, and then we're able to do everything on the back end in Epic, so that we can document the vaccine and we can upload to our state database and check all the boxes that we need to check. So what's been great about this process is that it's a great first run before we get to the larger community. What we're anticipating now is we anticipate enough vaccine supply that to cover the second dose, and then additional vaccine supply to start planning for the next phase, which will be phase 1B. And you may be aware that the federal government, the ACIP, voted and on who will be in that group, or what their recommendation is for that group, which will be frontline essential workers. That would include teachers, that would include grocery store workers, that would include transit workers, just as some examples. And then individuals 75 years of age and older, regardless of medical conditions. And so just to give you an idea, we're still working on getting an estimate. We're working with the health department on the frontline essential worker and who those who's in that category. So I kind of jot down on a piece of paper, and I have in my head what I think the estimate is, but I'm going to wait till we get a number from Dr. Locke and his team. But what I can tell you is we are able, one of the, powerful things about being the main healthcare provider and having an enterprise-wide EHR and having contact with so many residents, is just that we have data on our residents that we can begin planning in a way that other counties, I think, would find difficult, particularly big counties. So what we can anticipate is that we've got about 4,000 residents that are going to fall in that 75 and older category. And what we're doing is we have a few different ways to begin our planning about logistically how we would manage the outreach. And we have a few different approaches that we are contemplating about how, first of all, how we would sort that, because we don't know if we're going to get 4,000 vaccine at once. What's probably more likely is we might get 1,000 or 2,000 or 1,500 in 1 week, and then, some the next week. So we're planning different scenarios based on vaccine allotment and how we can sort those populations to make the logistics of getting folks in. Combination of being prepared for folks who may be reaching out to us and controlling that influx of interest, as well as reaching out and making sure that we're identifying some of our most fragile members of the community, and making sure that we're making sure they don't get, fall through the cracks, because maybe they don't follow us on Facebook and they don't have MyChart and things like that. So there's a lot of thought right now. We don't think we're going to get final go ahead from the state to move to 1B and final agreement on 1B. Hopefully they will give us who they agree is in the 1B category next, sooner rather than later. But what we're hearing from the state is anticipate movement to 1B more likely mid-January. And that will probably be because they have to make sure vaccine allocation is going to different areas around the state to make sure that the 1A worker population or 1A resident and worker population is covered first adequately. So they want to make sure they won't be able to keep us, I think, in full lockstep all the way through this. But I think one of the things that they want to be sure of is that before some counties are getting vaccine to start with residents, they want to make sure that other counties have finished their 1A supply. So that's where we're at right now. And like I said, I could kind of keep going on, but why don't I stop and then just open it up for questions, and we can kind of fill in the gaps that way.
I have a question. Is the dose for the, is the first dose and the second dose that you must receive the same?
Correct. So a couple things about first dose, second dose. So we have we have Pfizer vaccine right now, the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine, and that dose. So when you start with that dose, you have to, when you have your second dose, at this point, it is recommended that for it to be a complete vaccination, that you have to have first and second dose both of the same brand manufacturer. There's some talk out there that if someone has a reaction to the Pfizer vaccine, BioNTech with the first one, that question of could you do a second dose with the Moderna, or how do you do that? And that's, there'll be discussion about that. But for now, the main thing that we tell patients is if you start with, you know, Pfizer BioNTech, your second dose needs to be Pfizer BioNTech. That's a 21-day separation of the two. You can go 4 days early, interestingly. So you can do 4 days early. So you can do day 17, you can get your second dose. So there's a little 4 day grace period that they have included there. But in general, for most people, what we're doing is when they're getting their first vaccine, we're scheduling them 21 days later to get their second vaccine. Moderna is slightly different, still two doses. So if you start with Moderna, you got to end with Moderna, and that's a 28 day. And I've yet to hear, but I would anticipate or would not be surprised if we see something similar about a 4 day grace period. But at this point, I think the best way to think about it is that it's, you know, 28 days. And so anticipate whatever day you get your vaccine on that you're coming back, you know, 3 or 4 weeks later, depending on which vaccine it is. But avoiding, we don't want to mix and match, because at this point we would not consider that a complete series if we had a mix.
So when a new batch comes in, will that be used to, depending on the timing, will that be used to inoculate new people, or will it be to provide a second dose for the people already inoculated, or a combination?
Yeah, so what we're still, we're learning. So we actually received a second allocation. So we said that we thought with a single allocation of 975, and that 975, we actually is going to be more than 975, because what we're finding is that we can pull a sixth dose, an adequate sixth dose, a true sixth dose, in about 95%. It's not all of them. You have to be very careful that you are not breaking protocol. So if you do the protocol and there's a sixth dose in there, you can use it. If you follow the protocol and there's not a sixth dose, you're done. So there's no kind of, well, I'll just add a little more diluent, or I will pull a little bit out of this other vial. Don't do that. So, you know, people get real excited about how many extra doses can you get, but as a clinician and, you know, looking at this vaccine from a strict protocol standpoint, I'm like, if there's not, it's not in there, you get rid of it. So having said that, we are going to be able to get more doses out of it. So interestingly, we received an extra allocation that we weren't expecting. We didn't argue, and we're talking with the state about how to make use of that. We do know there's more 1A workers that we may work with the state to provide vaccine to. So we're having conversations right now about what to do with that, because the Pfizer allocations were split. So they held back what our second dose was going to be. So any vaccine that we got in the last week, we are confirming, but we understand that to be a fully separate allocation for first doses, and that we should be receiving a separate allocation for the second dose later on. So good position to be in. So we've got more vaccine, but we want to make sure that we're part of the solution to getting the state quicker out of 1A into 1B. So we're having conversations and working right now. Washington State Hospital Association is now going to be providing some assistance to the Department of Health to help provide the interface between the vaccine providers, particularly hospital systems and the DOH. DOH is just, you know, kind of overwhelmed right now. So we're working with our new intermediary to make sure that we understand our allocation and to see how we can be helpful. But right now, we're because of the size of our county, and this is the way it's going to work, a lot of the smaller counties are going to get through their 1A population a lot faster than King or Pierce or Snohomish until the vaccine supply kind of picks up. And some of the more populated areas are going to take a little longer time. And it's upon the DOH to allocate vaccines to the places that they need. So we fill out a survey to say how far along we are and do we have more 1A workers. And so, you know, we're happy to do more, but right now we're feeling pretty good where we're sitting, and we're anticipating the second doses to be extra shipments. Oh, I think you're muted, Mari.
If I can ask a question. So what, how long is it valid for each file? So, you know, it's expiration date, if you like, because as long as it's kept in, you know, the appropriate conditions, how long is it viable?
As long as it's in the freezer, I believe 6 months is okay. As long as it's in the ultra low code. So what happens is, and I won't kind of like, you know, try and botch the details. Jake would be the cold chain expert here, but once you move it out, so there is a specific process for thawing, moving it out of the freezer into either a regular freezer or refrigerator, and then coming out of the refrigerator. And then once you draw it up, a clock starts every time you do one of those processes. And, you know, so you go from, you know, 6 months to 5 days, and then you go from 5 days to, you know, 6 hours. And so one of the things, and this is one of take your hat off to the team who's been working the logistics. So Jake and his team and the vaccination nurses and pharmacy. Because what they do, this is part of the planning, and this is why something like a walk-up vaccine clinic doesn't work as well, is because one of our goals is 0% waste. This is a precious commodity, and if we drop a vaccine, it needs to go in an arm. And so that means you need to have an idea of how many vaccines you're doing so that you pull out the right amount. We actually have an on-call list. So in case someone no-shows for their appointment or an extra dose is drawn up and we don't have a place, we've had people who said, you know, yes, I'm in the 1A, but I am flexible. I'm in town, or I'm usually like in the administrative wing, or I'm, you know, over here in the clinic. So you can come find me, call me, and I'll come over and get my dose, you know, at that point if you've got an extra one left. So we're really being very careful about our doses and making sure that if something gets drawn up, we don't let anything go to waste. Because of that extra sixth dose, it gets a little bit hard for the numbers team to, you know, kind of do the math and projecting. So we're still using that 975 or kind of 5 doses per vial as a baseline number. I will tell you, from Moderna, doesn't require the dilution, and I think they're 10 doses per vial and multi-dose vial. So I don't know if we'll see something similar because it doesn't have the same process for reconstituting. It may just be, you know, 10 doses is 10 doses. So we don't know yet. And we don't know whether we're going to get Moderna or not at this point.
Thank
you.
If I could add, first of all, thanks, Joe. That was a great summary. I just want to add one comment that Dr. Locke made at the Board of Health meeting on the 17th. He said, "This is the most fragile vaccine ever. It just falls apart when you thaw it. But Jefferson Healthcare is fully up to the task." So that's his quote. So I want to say kudos to your entire staff that's working with this vaccine.
Yeah. It also is one of the reasons why it's not the kind of vaccine that you're like, oh, I got some, we'll just send it to you, or we'll just send it. So this idea of cold chain and transferring, there's a whole procedure. If you're going to take vaccine, you're going to send them to a different organization. And I know we got some feet early on when we reached out to, for example, paramedics. I think one of our, Jesse Michaels, who's been fantastic in connecting with community members, she got some feedback of, oh, we'll just take some, you just give us some vaccine, we can vaccinate ourselves. And she was like, no. Like, it doesn't work that way. And yes, you know how to vaccinate someone. That's not the issue. The storage and the handling and then the monitoring and the documentation of the vaccine is very strict protocol right now. And so if we're being kind of protective and saying, no, we'll just, you come to us, we're being a little bit controlling because we need to be. You want standardization and you want centralization in this situation. So for that very reason of you just can't have vaccine going to waste at this point. What other questions do you have?
I got one question, Joe. Can you hear me?
You're a little quiet, but I think I can hear you.
I just want to know if the Moderna vaccine has a, what's its rate of severe reactions? Because he said the Pfizer, or the email said the Pfizer was 1 in 40,000. You know what Moderna is?
Yeah, let's talk a little about the allergic reaction. So let's talk about the Pfizer one first. And so, you know, here's kind of what we knew going in with the Pfizer vaccine in the EUA. So one of the things that kind of know, they did exclude people who had a history of severe allergy. And the other thing too is you have to think about patient selection, who's going to sign up for a trial. And if you have a history of severe allergic reactions, you may be less likely to raise your hand to join a trial to begin with. So us, you know, one of the important things was what we knew about the vaccine was that some people get kind of these flu or COVID-like symptoms of fatigue, low-grade fever, aches, particularly after the second dose, mildly with the first dose, more commonly with the second dose. And so we were kind of ready for that. And severe adverse reactions, they didn't really have much. Moderna vaccine, there were a couple of people who did have allergic reactions, but it sounds like they were weeks to months after the vaccine, and so likely not related. But again, the population is skewed. So, Tom Locke might have talked about this at the Board of Health meeting. You know, essentially what we are in now is phase four of the trial. Now that we're releasing the vaccine into a larger population. Now we're gonna, you know, find out, you know, what happens, things that are kind of more unusual or things that maybe didn't happen because the trial population wasn't completely representative of the general population. And we're doing that because the known risk of the disease and the prevalence of the disease far outweighs what some of those risks would be at this point. So that's why we're in this emergency use authorization. So initially kind of published reports and, you know, ACIP, what they said was initially they collected reports of 6 anaphylactic or severe allergic reactions after about 270,000 doses. So that's about the 1 in 40,000. And that was on a slide this past weekend. We've had 2 allergic reactions, I will let you know so far, that were attended to, both patients doing fine, but did require some intervention and treatment, and we're reporting those to the system. I think there's more reports out in the media, and I think what you're gonna see is that some recognition that there does seem to be with the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, some more allergic reactions to it to differing degrees. So that's not changing the recommendations right now. The one recommendation is that, and in our situation, the individuals who had allergic reactions had a history of severe allergic reactions. So in some respects, we were prepared and they were in the right setting and we had the right materials and were able to do a prompt response. And right now the recommendation through ACIP and CDC is that unless you have an absolute known reaction to one part of the Pfizer vaccine, still proceed with caution. Because even again, having a severe allergic reaction that can be treated promptly is probably less risk long-term than getting COVID, particularly depending on your risk profile. So, but we're monitoring, and the reality is that, you know, we anticipate our counseling to patients may change. So in 2 weeks, it is possible that the ACIP said, wait, people with a severe allergic history, actually, we want them to wait or do a different vaccine. So guidance could change, but right now guidance hasn't changed. With regard to the Moderna, what we know is that they're both mRNA vaccines. They both have these little bits of genetic information that your cells will pick up and then create a protein based on that recipe. And then that protein is the spike protein that's on the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And your immune system will then create antibodies and an immune response or immune memory based on that protein that your body creates. There is one thing that the Moderna and another thing that I should say, the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines share in common, which is this, they need to have this nanolipid particle basically envelope. The way to get this very fragile piece of genetic material into your cells is you have to encase it in a little envelope. And in that envelope has something called polyethylene glycol. And that is the leading candidate for what is triggering the allergic reactions. We don't know. They have to collect more data. Moderna has that compound too. So I think we're going to be prepared that potentially people could react the same way to the Moderna vaccine. But we don't know yet. So we're going to be watching, we're going to be managing or looking and treating if we have Moderna vaccine the same way, which is that if you have a history of severe allergic reactions, we will be definitely, you know, doing that vaccination, not in a drive-in setting, but in the in-person setting, or I should say sort of, you know, in the building setting would probably be the right way to phrase that. So we don't know yet. What the Moderna safety data otherwise look very similar to Pfizer, which is first dose, some people get mild symptoms, second dose, more likely to have some fatigue, low-grade fever, some chills. Again, most of that stuff is quite self-limited, usually 24, 48 hours, and is part of the counseling and what we expect. I get a notice now once a day on my phone with a link for my survey that goes right to the CDC. It's the V-Safe program. We're encouraging everyone to subscribe to this. So this will help me, you know, help everyone collect data, and so that the CDC can say, okay, after, you know, 200,000 vaccines, you know, we're seeing this many people had reported allergic reactions or symptoms. And so there's an ongoing data collection, but it is definitely, consider this the next phase of the trial.
Hey, Joel?
Yeah.
My guess is that if we get Moderna vaccine, then your record keeping gets even more complicated and critical for the second dose on who gets what.
Yeah.
And then the question would be, it's not going to happen in Jefferson County, but somewhere it's going to happen that somebody gets the opposite for their second dose. Any idea what that will do?
You know, theoretically, probably not much. I don't think. I think the issue becomes it's this unknown, and you'd rather have the known than the unknown. And so for another situation, what's probably more common or more likely to happen is someone is going to miss their appointment or something's going to happen. There's a family emergency and their vaccine is late, you know, and what the guidance has been, yeah, you know, it should be at 21 days, but if it turns out to be a week later, we're going to count it as a second dose. Don't start the series over, and we'll kind of monitor. And that's the kind of thing that you work with your local health jurisdiction to kind of ask and monitor. You work with the manufacturer and see what you're going to do. So what the biggest problem, I don't think we would have any more risk for if I, you know, accidentally, you know, got a Pfizer first and then got confused and got the Moderna second. There was some sort of, you know, snafu. I wouldn't anticipate a harmful event for the patient. The question would be, what's your immune system doing? Are you going to get an adequate immune response? And do either one of those need to be repeated at a similar date? And it's just an unknown right now. But we do have logistically, I think we're in a good place again, because if we can get people, if we're responsible for folks in the county and people in the county feel like, you know, Jefferson Healthcare, hopefully we're their medical home anyway, but if they also say like, well, I normally get my care elsewhere, but they're my vaccine home, we're going to be in good place because we'll see what they've got. We're uploading this in Epic, which is all around the I-5 corridor. It's also going up to the state database. So if people are checking before second dose and they say, well, I got my second dose somewhere or first dose somewhere else, they should be able to look in the state database, see what they got. So there's a lot in place. The biggest thing on a scheduling standpoint is scheduling that appointment at the time of the first dose. And then when we know what you have for the first dose, we know this is what you should be getting for the second dose. We can schedule it appropriately. We can make it clear what we're scheduling you for. So logistically, it's more complicating, but it's completely manageable. You know, it's also this question of we're at a point where we're just doing Pfizer for some people and Moderna for others. We're going to have to definitely make sure we've got some safeguards in place because we're going to be thawing both. And you know, so we'll be kind of thawing, drawing up. So we're gonna have to make sure the draw up is different for Pfizer compared to the Moderna. One can come right out of the vial, the other one has to be diluted, and so there's some different processes, but it's a big area of attention for us. But if that's the difference between getting a lot more people vaccinated quicker, is we'll send you both, I would take that logistical problem and say, sure, you know, give us 2,500 of both and we'll figure it out, as opposed to, or, you know, well, we can only send you 1,000 of one at a time. I'd rather have that problem to solve. So
Joe, just to backtrack to the reactions, the Pfizer BioNTech, you said 1 in 40,000. Did you say what it was for Moderna?
We don't know yet. We don't know for serious. There were two, my understanding is there were two serious allergic reactions, but they did not coincide at the time of the vaccine. And so they could have been people who, you know, had allergic reaction because they had some shellfish, 3 weeks later. They don't kind of differentiate. So it sounded like they did not feel that that was vaccine related in the trial. So we won't know until, kind of in the next week, we'll be watching to see news reports for Moderna, and I suspect you're going to hear more, you know, because as we report that we've had allergic reactions, and there's other places that I think are going to be putting that in, and so we'll see if there's some trends.
And the other thing is, if someone reacts specifically or to a shingles second dose shingles vaccine, which can bring about the same fairly minor complications of, you know, headache and a fever and feeling generally flu-like, are they more likely to have issues with the Pfizer, or is it nobody's?
I think I'd separate, not necessarily allergic. So that's kind of a normal, that's a sign of your immune system
cranking
kind
up,
of getting activated by it. In some respects, I was talking with colleagues that some of us are kind of, we want a little bit of symptoms. Like I kind of want a little bit of sore arm, and I want a little bit of kind of feeling achy and chilled, because I kind of want my immune system to, kind of deal with it and create an immunity plan for me. So to me, that actually maybe sometimes when I hear that story about something like the shingles vaccine, I'll have patients come in and they're not happy about it, but I kind of look at the silver lining of, I'm sorry you felt that way. You know, good news. Hopefully that means your immune system truly kind of got a little bit of a, boost from this and, kind of got tested. We do see fewer adverse reactions like that, the fatigue, the chills, the achiness in an older population, probably because the immune response typically tends not to be as strong. There may be a little difference. The Pfizer vaccine may have a little better immune response in people over 65 compared to the Moderna. I think the numbers trended a little bit less for the efficacy in Moderna. Still very highly effective, and certainly compared to other vaccine responses, much stronger. So overall, this is a really good vaccine from getting a good immune response. But yeah, and so then on the allergy side, if you've had those kinds of symptoms from an injection before, it's different, and that doesn't correlate with, am I going to get hives? Am I going to get, you know, wheezing, difficulty breathing, full body rash, kind of immediate reaction kind of stuff? That's really more of a trip, kind of an allergy pathway, which is a different type of hypersensitivity.
Yeah. Thank you.
We are very, very running very late, and it's
sorry.
Well worth it. The content was excellent, but Dr. Banner, and I think you deserve some time off here.
Well, thanks. Yeah, you know, there are materials. I think as the commission, I think you have access to the videos and the education that we've got posted on the website, and so certainly can make use of those things. And then I'm happy to answer questions as we go along. Overall, we're in a great place. And what I would tell you, and when people in the community ask you, because they will ask you, I think what you can tell them is you've got a great logistical team. You know, first of all, you've got the commitment from the organization that we are going to be part of the solution to this problem. We view it as, you know, part of our duty. We want to work with community partners and health department. But we're prepared to do a significant part of the lift of getting this community vaccinated. And we're in a good place right now. We've got the materials, we've got the team, we got the technology. And as long as they keep sending us vaccine, we will find a way to get it into our patients and community members. So
if I could add one comment and I'll do this instead of my report from the Board of Health, there's one warning that I want to make sure gets across to everybody. And it was outlined in a New York Times article just yesterday, which is entitled, "Here's Why Vaccinated People Still Need to Wear a Mask. The new vaccines will probably prevent you from getting very sick with COVID, but it does not prevent you from acquiring the infection, and no one yet knows whether it will keep you from spreading the virus to others." So this is something that I think we really need to get out there loud and clear to everyone in this community.
Yeah, I'd second that. And that's been a big part of the education that we've done locally, and something that we emphasize with people who are coming through for the vaccine. And we will continue that with as we roll this out to the greater community. And they are working on, they are doing some trials to study that very question of, are you less likely to spread or shed? But we don't have that documented yet. So until the numbers go down, and this is simply another layer of protection on top of socially distancing, wearing a mask, washing your hands, avoiding gatherings that particularly indoors with people outside of your household. So all these things that make a difference, this is simply providing a new layer of safety. And then eventually, you know, when the numbers are down and we've got better evidence for the vaccine, will come the time when we can start to peel some of those things away. But the time is not now.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Mattern. And thank you, too, Mike. You kind of got waylaid there, but, you know, in the distance there. But thank you for your report as well. Do you have anything to add to yours, Mike?
No,
he fell asleep. Okay. There he is. Okay.
Thank you. Great. Thank you, Dr. Mattern. Okay. All right, then we will move on to board business. Did you have anything else that you wanted to talk about, Case, with your Board of Health report?
No, it's all available online. And again, much of our time was spent looking at the COVID-19 situation. Joe, I think, covered that very, very well. So there's nothing additional that I need to add.
Okay. Mari, you've got your hand up there.
Yes, I have some, I think, very good news. First of all, a big thank you to Jefferson Healthcare staff for their contributions to UGN so far. $22,985 have been received by UGN from Jefferson Healthcare staff. So thank you very much to all those who have contributed. And better for the Jefferson Healthcare Foundation, we applied for a grant from the All in Washington Fund of the Seattle Foundation, and Jefferson Healthcare Foundation has been awarded $45,000 to allow us to continue to support employees' childcare problems. So $45,000, I just learned that this afternoon as I was setting up for this meeting. So I think the congratulations to Chris Becker, who's looking for money for to try and help support our employees' issues with childcare. Thank you.
Great. Nice report.
Well, it is when it's money coming our way.
Yes. Absolutely.
Or the community's way.
All right. Next, we'll go to Resolution 2020-16, Health Equity. Case, as a committee chair, would you like to talk about the health equity resolution?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And as soon as I make a few comments, I'd love to have Bruce also make some comments, since he was part of the team that crafted the resolution that we submitted to the commissioners. The latest version that we sent was version number 5, which I hope you all have with you. We had previously settled on draft number 4, Bruce and I had, but then when a competing resolution was presented last month, and at some other time, we might want to talk about the process with which that occurred. We then began to realize that perhaps we needed to make a few adjustments to try to see whether we could reach consensus on a resolution. And so we sent the draft number 5. A couple of things that I'd like to point out in draft number 5. First of all, I would like to say that I had already taken out one section that was part of the racism resolution that was passed by the Board of Health. And I would just like to read that in my working with Bruce McComas. I just want to read that particular sentence, which was that I believe that we in Jefferson County live and work on land that was usurped from indigenous peoples, and that the ongoing presence of systemic, cultural, and personal racism in this country continues to distribute privilege and access inequitably. Once again, my own personal belief is that it is worth acknowledging the role that our culture has played in its effect on indigenous peoples, both in this part of the world, in this part of the country, and around the world. A couple of important additions that were also made to the resolution was one that I actually, in retrospect, think should be attributed to Mike Glenn, because it's a direct quote from a very moving document that Mike Glenn sent out to all staff on the 8th of June, which was less than 2 weeks after the senseless and tragic loss of George Floyd's life, which I would call murder, but I will try to avoid talking about that. And that sentence is, number 1A on the draft that you have, which is, the loss of George Floyd's life was as senseless as it was tragic, served as a wake-up call. Excuse me, I need to adjust my paper here. Served as a wake-up call about racial disparity inequality and social injustice in our communities. As the healthcare provider in our community, it's important for Jefferson Healthcare to take a stand against racism and all other forms of social injustice. Bruce and I agreed that we would take out some of the further references to BIPOC, which is a term that is currently widely used to stand for Black, Indigenous, and people of color. We also took out a significant quote from John Lewis, great civil rights leader, again, a quote that was in the resolution passed by the Board of Health. So that's all that I think I need to state at this on this go around. And I'd like to ask Bruce whether he would like to make a few comments.
Yes, Bruce.
Sure. This was, it's always been a work in progress, you know. I mean, we started off, that's why we ended up with five versions, you know. And things change, and I always felt like, you know, that it needed to be something that was specific and worked for Jefferson Healthcare, because we're not the county, we're not the state, we're not the United States. And, you know, our demographics and our charge is different than all those. I've always felt that, you know, what we do is more important than, at least is important, probably more important than what we say. This started before we got involved with the Institute for Health. And, you know, I think that will help us do, we'll learn, you know, from that, and it'll help us do, and it'll give us some metrics to gauge on how well we're doing for making changes where necessary. I enjoyed working with Case on it, and we just need to make sure that it's something that speaks to Jefferson Healthcare and, you know, what our mission is. And I hope that we did that by the time we got to the fifth version, but.
All right. Thank you, both of you, for your comments. For protocol, and to observe Robert's Rules of Order, I will ask for a motion to approve that resolution. That would be Resolution 2020-16, Health Equity. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that Resolution 2020-16 be approved. Is there discussion?
If I could get a point of clarification first, Jill?
Yes. Yes.
You are talking about draft number 5, submitted.
Yes,
submitted.
The one that we're just discussing.
Thank you.
Yes. Is there discussion? All right. I would like to say I thank you very much, both of you, for putting all of the time and effort into it. This is a very important issue, and I think we've got it right. I was concerned about about limiting it and being too specific, because I felt that by being overly specific, you exclude. If you try to be too inclusive, there's a danger of excluding segments of the population. And I feel very, very strongly that we are here for every single person in this community. And we do not want to risk alienating anyone or making anyone who comes through that door feel unwelcome or uncomfortable to come through that door.
So I applaud your efforts, and I am enough said. And so, Mari, I see your hand up.
Yeah, I'm really pleased that I know Case is obviously frustrated by the time it's being taken. But the version I'm looking at is the one that Case sent out. Is that the correct one?
Yes, the last okay, one. That is, yes.
Yeah. And so it does say resolution of the Jefferson Healthcare Board, and we're not. We're the public. We're the Jefferson County Public Hospital District number 2. So I believe that needs to be changed.
All right. That's a good point.
And I think there's another place where it said there. So that was just really a point of order. The other thing, the quote from Martin Luther King's speech, I would like to include additionally in there, I have a dream that my 4 little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And I don't know how anybody else feels about that, but I would like to amend the current one to include that.
I will second that motion, Mari.
Thank you.
Is there any discussion on that? All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? All right, that's unanimous.
And there's something else. I don't want to be too nitpicky, but on page 3, we fully support the Jefferson Healthcare staff and their commitment to address discrimination, blah, blah, blah. I would like to include Jefferson Healthcare or the district's administration and staff, because I think the administration... the staff are working on it, but the administration is has been driving it. So, but it's not essential to include.
Isn't administration part of staff? I mean,
well, they are part of staff, but it came from the top. It came from the SLG and the administrator.
Okay, so will you put that in the form of a motion, please?
I would like on page 3. Which I will shuffle and hopefully find.
What's the item number, Mari?
It's not. It's now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of, and this is another where it needs to be the Board of Jefferson Healthcare. It needs to be the Board of Public Hospital District number 2. We, the Board of Commissioners of the Public Hospital District of number 2 of Jefferson County, declare that we are against discrimination in any form, or it's racism and discrimination in any form. We fully support the Jefferson Healthcare Administration and staff. So it's on the 1, 2, 3, 4th line down, where after Jefferson Healthcare, it should be the hospital district, administration and staff.
So you're adding, basically we're changing the name to its proper name, and then
And then adding administration and staff before the and staff.
All right. Is there a second to that motion? No second?
Second.
All right. Is there discussion?
Yeah, I would feel better if we said, since they are staff, it would be technically incorrect to link those two in that way. We could say fully support the staff, comma, especially the administration, or in some way, give them credit. But I do have some difficulty in listing them as if they aren't part of the staff.
All right. Is there is a motion and a second? So if there's no further discussion, Mari, you look like you want to say.
Well, I was just going to say, could we work on the wordsmithing of this? Or,
well, if you do that, then
we've got to do it again. Right.
Well, or could you say administration and employees rather than administration and staff?
Well, but they're all the administration are employees as well.
Yeah.
But all employees are not administration.
If a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to listen, I know. Okay. Let's go back to the basics here. And we have a motion and a second. All in favor of the motion as Mari read it, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say aye.
Aye or nay.
Well, no, you're supposed to say aye because you're going for I'm opposed. If you say.
Anyway, I think you get the picture.
Yes. So I heard one aye for yes. Yes for passage. And I heard one for failure, not passage. Is there, are there abstentions? Because that's only two votes.
Yeah, I abstain. At this point, I don't care.
I'm with you. Nay. Okay, I will say chair votes no. Because of the I think that's a conflict between administration and staff being separate in that context.
And then can I have a clarification on the previous amendment to change everywhere where it says Jefferson Healthcare Board of Commissioners or Jefferson Healthcare?
Just make that. Why don't you make that a new motion?
So because it should be proper, if we're doing this proper, it yes. should be proper. So everywhere where it is relevant throughout this resolution, that Jefferson Healthcare Board of Commissioners or Jefferson Healthcare, the reference should be changed to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District number 2.
Right. Is there a second?
Before there's a second to that, could I make a brief suggestion that might make the reading of this a little easier? In the title of the resolution, the very top, I would agree that it's important to say who we are. That could actually be included in the very first sentence, in which we could say,
AKA.
AKA Jefferson Healthcare.
DBA doing business.
Use Jefferson Healthcare as a shorthand throughout the document.
Does that make you want to amend your motion, Mari?
As in Bruce, it's not that I don't care, I don't mind.
All right. Is there a second to that?
I will second the amended motion that Mari seems to have not minded.
All right. All right. Is there further discussion? Hopefully not. No. All right. All in favor of the amended motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Any opposed? All right. Passed.
And could I make one other motion, please, which is in the very beginning there, 1A, where it talks about that should be in quotes and attributed to Mike Glenn. I would appreciate that being put in there.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? All right, all in favor?
Discussion, it should say Mike Glenn and Jefferson Healthcare CEO.
Yes, correct.
All right. Any further discussion? All right, all in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, it passes. Now, back to the main motion, and that is the passing of the resolution itself. So if there's no further discussion,
I would just like to say, because I was in on my amendments, I do agree very deeply with you, Chair. regarding what we do and how we do things for our community members. And when we maybe focus on one aspect of our community, people who maybe are suffering from issues, social determinants of health, whether it's housing, poverty, education, discrimination of any kind, whether it's race, gender, all of those things, I think it's very important for us to be very mindful when we do this kind of thing, because when we call out and recognize one particular group, then we exclude and potentially discriminate against other members of our community. And that is the last thing I would ever want to do. As a bedside clinical nurse, it's never mattered to me over my 50 years of my career, where I was a clinical provider at the bedside, who my patient was, where they came from, what they thought, what their status was in the community, whether they're poor or homeless or lacking in education. I always tried to deliver the care to them that I would want for myself in that situation. So I do think we should be very mindful of selecting and focusing on members, small groups or larger groups of the community, at potentially the discrimination of others who are not included.
Mari, if I could add to that, that I totally agree with that. And I hope that there will be other times in the future when we can highlight other groups that are particularly relevant. This is the time, in my belief, and I want to thank everyone for their support of this. This is the time where we do need to stand up against racism specifically. And that may happen to another group in the future, and I hope we do. And if I might just share a 30-second story, my father, during the Nazi occupation of Holland, developed the first artificial kidney. And during the occupation, the very first patient whom he saved from acute renal failure was a Nazi sympathizer. And so the belief of treating everyone, regardless of who they are, is one that I also feel very strongly about.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that case, because, you know, my father also was as a Frenchman born on the German border, suffered during World War II considerably, and it's a very good reminder of what can happen in societies. But I also feel that we also need to focus on what's happening with our communities in our county.
Yes.
So I would just like to say, while everybody's talking about this, is that, you know, the first part of this is really just background. And to me, the more important part is the resolution, the very last part. And there's two sentences in there that I think address what Mari's talking about, but I think are very relevant. And it says, we will strive to eliminate all forms of discrimination in our policies, practices, and procedures in order to reduce and eventually eliminate disparities in health equity in our system. And the very last sentence, we believe there should be a fair and just opportunity for everyone to be healthy.
Yep. Perfect.
Okay. Any further discussion? And all in favor of passing resolution 2020-16, health equity, say aye.
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 Aye. Is there opposition? No. Passed unanimously. Thank you, everyone. Well done. Then we will move on to board consultation with attorney. This has come about as a suggestion for hopefully final resolution of a question that one of our board members has regarding recording meetings as a commissioner and as a private individual. and the difference and what kind of, we need a definitive answer on the right of the individual to do so, and also the consequences of the action if it's not done in the way prescribed by the RCW, if it the responsibility that goes with that. So, and what the ramifications to the organization would be if it is not done properly. So Case, I believe you had in mind a motion to make regarding that board consultation. Do you want to make a motion to that? You said it very well.
I'd be happy to. I move that the board hire an independent outside attorney to address the all of the questions that have been raised concerning the recording of the minutes of Jefferson Healthcare board meetings.
All right, is there a second to that?
Second.
Okay, discussion, and one of the items is that we would pay for this attorney out of the board budget, as there's been very little travel this year and very little, virtually no, except for one early on, conferences that we normally attend. We do have some money left over in the budget that would cover this. So that would be where the way that we would accomplish it without going into other monies. So is there other discussion? Mari?
I would ask Case, who made the motion, whether we need the word minutes in there, because it's a live recording, it's a live meeting.
You're right. Yes, probably not correct. It should be just meetings.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Thanks, Case.
All right. All in favor of the resolution, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Abstentions? Chair votes aye. So that is unanimous. We will take care of the logistics on that at a later date.
And Jill, could I ask just a quick question?
Certainly.
Perhaps we could put on an agenda January, February, whenever it is decided, for the board to review the specific way in which the questions and issues are phrased, are posed for the attorney.
Yes, actually, I was going to bring up, you kind of
jumped the gun.
Yeah, but you didn't know you were, but you're a step ahead of me.
Oh, no.
I was going to suggest that this early in January, before the next regular meeting, we schedule a board book meeting and at the same time a board evaluation. With board self-evaluation and board book special meeting. It's not an executive session. It would just be a special meeting because it would be held separately and apart from our regular meeting. And we would find a date in the first, not the first week, but between the second, third week that everyone would be able to attend virtually. So that's what I'm going to suggest, and I don't need a vote on it now or anything. That's what I have in mind, and that's what I'm going to call for. So at that time, that fits just perfectly with your suggestion, Case. So keep your eyes open for that email and scheduling. So is there other board business?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
J- just to wish my colleagues a very happy Christmas, and don't eat too much, don't drink too much, and enjoy.
Well, yes, and we do have an executive session that we will be going into, and then we will come out after that and conclude the meeting. So at this point, we will move into the meeting evaluation. Mari, you're first on the alpha list. What's your evaluation of today's meeting?
It exceeds my expectations, and it was good.
Okay. Case?
Yeah, I think it was great. I think everyone seemed to me that people felt comfortable sharing their points of view, and that we all listened to each other very attentively. And once again, I appreciate all of the work that that you and Mari and Mike and the rest of the staff put into planning these sessions, these meetings.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. And Bruce?
Yeah, I don't have anything additional to add. It was a good meeting. Always lots of great information.
Mm-hmm. Matt?
Ton of great information. Very well done meeting. Thank you for all the work into it.
Okay, and I have no more to say other than I agree with all of you. So at this time then, we will go into executive session, and we will go in, let's see, it is what now, what time?
17:52.
Okay, 5:52. And we were going into it for a performance review of a public employee. We will come out at, we need, 6:15. And action will be taken. So right now, I will go ahead and we will sign off here and go, the board will go into, and Mike will go into the, other Zoom meeting, and then we will come back here at 6:15.
And just to confirm, Jill, this is John, that your action will be taken following the executive session, correct?
Yes, that will be in an open session at 6:15. Thank you, John. Thank you, everyone, and Merry Christmas. Okay, are we recording?
Hold it to record. There we go.
Okay. We are out of executive session. We still have more work to do. It is 6:15 right now, or 6:16. We will be back. We will go back into executive session. Is there anyone on the line, Brittany, who's waiting for anything?
No, there is not.
Okay. So we'll go back in now, and we will be out in another 15 minutes, so 6:30.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Good evening. It is 6:33, and we are back in regular session. I would like a motion to approve compensation increase for our CEO Mike Glenn, who is $35,374 currently below the average of his colleagues for his salary, that he be given a 5% increase of $12,306 for a total compensation base pay of $258,429, which still puts him in the lower half of his peers, plus the ability to cash in 100 hours of the paid time off he has already earned, and an additional 80 hours of vacation time, which he promises he will take next year.
So move.
Second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. Is there discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Abstain?
I'll abstain.
All right, that is 4 ayes and 1 abstention. Thank you, everyone. And then we will now, I will now ask for a motion to conclude the meeting.
So moved.
Second. It's been moved. Don't everybody do it at once. Okay, everybody, have a great Christmas and New Year, and we'll schedule a special meeting for the first part of January.
And just a special thank you to Brittany. It's just such a joy to have her working for this board. And
yes.
Brittany, have a wonderful holiday. Well deserved.
Thank you. Absolutely. My pleasure. I appreciate you all.
Everybody
thank
stay
you for
safe.
Hanging in there. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Thank you for hanging in there with us tonight, Brittany.
My pleasure. Happy holidays, you guys.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.